The notion that anyone might discover he was sending her secret telegrams was unthinkable. He blew her the ghost of a kiss.
Precipice by Robert Harris on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday night at 10:45.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 7th of November. Good morning. This is Today with Amol Rajan in London and Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. The headlines today: President-elect Trump has said he will meet Joe Biden to ensure a smooth transition of power as he prepares to choose his White House team. It's still not clear whether Republicans will have control of the House of Representatives, which would give them a clean sweep of Congress and the White House. Coming up in today's program, will Donald Trump govern differently this time round?
Donald Trump learned his first 4 years some things that I think, had to do it again, he would do them differently. And now is that time.
And I've been speaking to Democrats at Kamala Harris's concession speech.
I think it's just a sign of the America we live in, that we've always lived in. And the truth is now just slapping us in the face.
And when you say the truth being what?
You know what the truth is. We all know what the truth is. So
come on, tell me.
No, you know, sexist and racism.
Also in today's program,
Anderson is in now, up to the wicket, bowls out of Clark.
England's most successful bowler in Test cricket, Jimmy Anderson, joins me in the studio. Here's hoping we're not left stumped. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team has said that the US president-elect is preparing to select his cabinet less than 24 hours after his dramatic political comeback. Mr. Trump is said to be looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power after he beat Kamala Harris yesterday. He'll take office on January the 20th. Our correspondent Neda Tofik reports from Florida, where Mr. Trump's team is based.
Donald Trump's transition team says that in the coming days, he will be selecting the best people to join his administration to make the lives of Americans affordable, safe, and secure. A visit to the White House is expected to take place in the near future after Joe Biden called to congratulate the president-elect on his victory and extended an invitation to the Oval Office to ensure a smooth transition. It's a courtesy Donald Trump did not afford Mr. Biden 4 years ago when he lost the election. A tone of civility between political rivals is holding for now, with Mr. Trump's spokesperson saying that he appreciated Joe Biden's call.
Kamala Harris conceded the election to Mr. Trump yesterday evening in a speech on the steps of Howard University in Washington, where she'd been a student. She urged her Democrat supporters to keep fighting for what they believed in.
It is okay to feel sad and disappointed, but please know it's going to be okay. On the campaign, I would often say, when we fight, we win. But here's the thing. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is, don't ever give up.
Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to Donald Trump to congratulate him on his victory. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
In his phone call, Sir Keir offered Donald Trump what a Downing Street spokesperson described as hearty congratulations for an historic victory. The two men may be far apart politically, but they apparently spoke fondly about their meeting in New York in September when the Prime Minister had dinner with the then presidential candidate to try to start preparing the ground in case he won. Sir Keir's spokesperson said on their call the two agreed that the relationship between the UK and the US was incredibly strong and would continue to thrive.
Sir Keir will be among European leaders who will discuss the impact of Donald Trump's victory on Ukraine at a summit in Hungary. Our Europe editor Katja Adler is at a meeting in Budapest.
Donald Trump will be the main focus of today's meeting. What his return to the White House might mean in terms of trade tariffs, China policy, European security, and perhaps most urgently, the future of Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Budapest. He remarked that US leadership is vital for a just peace after speaking to Donald Trump yesterday. But the fear here is the new US administration will slow, if not stop, the flow of American military aid to Kyiv. Donald Trump has boasted in the past he could end the war with Russia in a day. What isn't clear is whether he wants Ukraine to win.
Germany's three-party coalition has collapsed after one of the parties quit the government. The Liberal Free Democratic Party pulled out after the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz sacked the Finance Minister Christian Lindner because of a dispute about debt. The political crisis could trigger early elections by the end of March. Several large airstrikes have hit the southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital earlier this morning, an hour after the Israeli army told residents to leave. There were no immediate reports of casualties. Earlier, Lebanon's health ministry said at least 40 people had been killed yesterday during Israeli bombing in the east of the country. Our correspondent Joe Inwood is monitoring events from Jerusalem.
Israel's campaign against Hezbollah shows no sign of slowing. This was Beirut overnight, the sky lit up by huge explosions. Israel says it hit Hezbollah command centers and weapon stores. There were attacks too in the Bekaa Valley, with 16 killed in the village of Nasriya and 11 in Baalbek City. According to the Lebanese Minister of Culture, the strike severely damaged the Ottoman-era Manshia building. Mohammed Mortada said it was an irredeemable loss for Lebanon and for world heritage.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has suggested she wants to stop some new council homes in England from being sold under right to buy. The scheme allows social housing tenants to purchase their homes, often at a significant discount. Ms. Rayner told the BBC that the restrictions on new builds would help address what she called a homelessness crisis.
We started a consultation on how we take things forward, and we've also restricted the sale of new council homes. I don't want them leaving the system, so therefore we've put checks and balances in place.
A 600-year-old Renaissance masterpiece will go on public display for the first time after the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford raised millions of pounds to buy it. Fra Angelico's crucifixion had been at risk of being taken out of the country. Here's our culture reporter Guy Lambert.
Painted on a gold panel in luminous colours, Fra Angelico's earliest surviving work depicts Christ on the cross, with the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene and St John the Evangelist at his feet. The painting had been in the UK for about two centuries, but it was sold to an overseas buyer in July. The government placed a temporary bar on the painting's export, giving the Ashmolean enough time to raise almost £4.5 million to acquire the masterpiece, thanks to more than 50 major donors and a public appeal. It will now go on display for the first time.
That was our culture reporter, Guy Lambert.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. See you again shortly. It's 7 minutes past six and time to say good morning for a first look at the weather to Simon King in the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Simon.
Hi, Amol. Good morning. It is very mild out there across many parts of the UK. In particular, the northwest of Scotland at the moment, 18 degrees Celsius. That's way above the average of 2 or 3 degrees at this time of year. So, temperatures, particularly across Scotland and Northern Ireland, on the high side. But again, it's another cloudy start to the day with some mist and some fog. So for southwest England and across Wales, the areas of mist and fog will tend to lift up and clear away. There's also a little bit of drizzle out there this morning as well. And there's going to be a little change through the day, but the breeze will start to pick up a bit more. And that will hopefully break the cloud up just a touch towards the west of Wales, maybe parts of southwest England as well. Temperatures getting up to about 11 to 16 degrees Celsius. In southeast England, eastern England and across the Midlands, it's again pretty misty and overcast, and there really will be little change into the afternoon with highs of 12 to 15 degrees. Across northern England, thick and low cloud, a bit of mist out there, some drizzle as well. The mist will lift, the drizzle will stop, it will stay cloudy, and temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius. Across Northern Ireland, a very mild start to the day, some mist and some murk. It's going to be quite breezy into the afternoon, and that will tend to break the cloud up a little bit, so some brighter spells, temperatures of 14 or 15 degrees. And across Scotland today, very mild start, as I've mentioned. Some sunny spells across Northern Scotland, where temperatures will be 16 to 18 Celsius. For Central and Southern Scotland, it will stay fairly cloudy, with temperatures of 11 to 14.
Thank you, Simon. 9 minutes past six. Let's have our first look at the papers. A smiling Donald Trump on every front page. Landslide is the headline in The Eye, which says he's won a mandate for a radical right-wing agenda to reshape America.
The
Sun says that he's been rehired after he was shot, sued, tried, insulted and written off. Rehired, of course, a reference to The Apprentice, which he hosted in America. The paper says it's not bewildered by the second coming of President Trump because most Americans love capitalism, freedom and aspiration and detest socialism, meddling regulations and wokery.
The Daily Mirror strikes a different tone, asking, what have they done again? The paper says there are fears Mr. Trump will be even more divisive and brutal than in his first term. In a separate editorial, The Mirror declares, this is a dark day for America. It says US allies must prepare for a new world order under a president who favours tyrants and strongmen such as Vladimir Putin over them.
For the Daily Mail, his victory is a comeback to Trump all comebacks. The paper, Trump all comebacks, get it? The paper says liberals in the US and Britain have been left bewildered and tearful. And the result is a nightmare for, as it puts it, Starmer and his Donald-loathing cabinet.
The paper's columnist Sarah Vine argues that one of Kamala Harris's biggest mistakes was to assume that all women would side with her just because she's a woman of colour. The author says Ms. Harris showed spectacularly poor judgment by believing that women were more interested in abortion rights than in improving the economy and tackling illegal immigration.
Under the headline, American Dread, The Guardian says people in the US have woken up to a transformed country and a rattled world. While the Financial Times warns that Mr. Trump's comeback is expected to pitch American democracy, US alliances and global markets into an era of upheaval.
The political editor of the Daily Express, Sam Lister, says the relentless and often over-the-top attacks on Donald Trump made by many of the most senior ministers in Sakir's cabinet from the safety of opposition are now coming back to haunt the prime minister. She says Mr. Trump is not known for being a man who takes kindly to personal attacks, and Sakir is in the position of coming close to grovelling to the leader of the free world.
In an editorial, The Times says the global economy could suffer a heart attack if Mr. Trump carries out his threat to impose a 60% tariff on imports from China and 20% from the rest of the world. The paper is also concerned that he might force Ukraine to make territorial concessions to Russia, thereby validating Moscow's reinvasion, which could be seen as a green light for attacks by other authoritarian regimes.
And finally, The Guardian says US polling agencies are under fire because they didn't foresee Mr. Trump's triumph. The paper says the failure occurred despite pollsters claiming they'd recalibrated their methodology after they seriously underestimated Donald Trump's support in 2016 and to an extent in 2020 as well.
Time now is 11 minutes past six.
And all eyes are on Donald Trump's Florida home, on the transition team that needs to be formed to get appointments underway for his second term. Helena Humphrey joins us from there. Mr. Trump himself not appearing yet, Helena, just on the phone, one assumes.
Yes, of course, we had his victory speech, and I think one of the key lines in that victory speech had been promises made will be promises kept. Of course, many people ask in the wake of campaigns that are becoming ever more popular in their talking points, will candidates really carry out what they have promised? But of course, we know that Donald Trump has promised to close the border, to carry out a mass deportation, he has said, of undocumented immigrants from day one, drill, 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 end inflation, which already is coming down, and cut climate regulations as well. A lot of eyes are now looking, as you just mentioned there, to that transition team. Who will be appointed? We know already that he has pointed to RFK Jr., of course, the Republican, former Republican candidate, who then, I should say independent, who put his Republican support behind Donald Trump, saying that he could have a role on the health team. This is somebody who has espoused misinformation when it comes to vaccines, HIV, AIDS, also, of course, looking at Elon Musk with his endorsement and financial backing for Donald Trump. And then other people like Marco Rubio, for example, the Florida senator. Could he be in a role as Secretary of Defense? He is someone who has said that funding to Ukraine should be cut, something that we've heard frequently on the campaign trail from Donald Trump supporters. So a lot of question marks right now as to how exactly those campaign pledges will be enacted. But certainly things are moving pretty quickly here, and he will be inaugurated on the 20th of January, of course.
And he's also popping up to the White House.
Yes, he will be popping up to the White House. We know that Joe Biden has already spoken to him by phone, as, of course, has Kamala Harris, to deliver her concession before delivering that concession speech at Howard University. We are seeing the traditions of the smooth handover of power start to be enacted already. Of course, those comments as well coming from world leaders, including Sir Keir Starmer, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, all with a congratulatory and positive tone, because they know that ultimately this is the person that they will be working with for the next 4 years. It comes at a time when here in the United States, the country is feeling polarized. And I think from the Democratic side, the objective here is to try and make sure that this is a peaceful transition at a time when half the country is feeling elated and half the country, to a certain extent, is feeling in shock, if not heartbroken.
Helena Humphrey, thank you.
Well, one of those world leaders that Helena mentions is Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's outside Netanyahu's Jerusalem residence that there have been protests this week, and specifically yesterday. Let's talk to our correspondent, Joe Inwood, who is in Jerusalem. Joe, morning from London. What are these protests outside Netanyahu's residence about?
So the protests were more specifically about the firing of Yoav Gallant. He's the defense minister. That took place a couple of days ago, just hours before we got the result in America. Now, he was seen as one of the last sort of restraining influences on Prime Minister Netanyahu, but their relationship had broken down really beyond repair. So we've had protesters on the street for the last couple of days, very keen to see him either back in place or to see somebody replace him who they think is going to be, who the protesters, who are often the hostage families, think are going to be more amenable to some sort of deal. And that was in his resignation statement. Yoav Gallant was saying, we spoke about this yesterday, that there were irreconcilable differences on a number of issues. Helena was talking there about the reception for Donald Trump and various world leaders. And I think it's worth saying, or worth mentioning, that one of the world leaders who'd be most pleased to see Mr. Trump return to the White House is Mr. Netanyahu. They've got a very close relationship, they have done for a number of years, and they had a 20-minute call yesterday which was described as warm and cordial. What was interesting is that the two things they focused on were security and what was called the Iranian threat. So there is going to be a focus in this new relationship between the two men on those issues.
And just a quick thought, Joe, on what else has been happening in the Middle East. Obviously, a huge amount of action. Israel engaged in military conflict in several directions. And yesterday, there were further Israeli attacks on Beirut in Lebanon.
Yeah, I think there's been no let-up, really. As you, I was mentioning the bulletins here, we've seen huge airstrikes overnight in the Dahiya suburb of southern Beirut. There were these huge explosions, fireballs in the night sky. Israel says it was targeting Hezbollah command and control centres and ammo dumps. We don't have reports of any injuries yet, but we know that there were a number of casualties in the Bekaa Valley. That's in the east of the country. We've got 16 people killed in Nasiriyah and 11 in Balbek City. Now, one point that is worth mentioning is that there was a report from the Lebanese culture minister that the Manshia building, that's an Ottoman era building, was destroyed. That's in the vicinity of a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We don't think it was the heritage site itself, which is an ancient Phoenician city. We don't think that was hit, but it was a historic building nearby. So concern over the security of that site.
Joe Inwood in Jerusalem. Good to talk to you. Thank you.
17 minutes past six. Global stock markets suggest there are going to be clear winners and losers of a second Trump presidency. The offshore wind sector is definitely in the loser camp. Mr. Trump has made it clear on plenty of occasions he doesn't think much of wind. Will Bain has more on that than the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Justin. Yes, as you will well know, and as we'll hear throughout the business, Mr. Trump can be pretty blunt, and his quotes moving some of the markets already on day one. In fact, almost immediately we saw shares in banks, for example, rise on the potential of a bit less regulation there. And Tesla, the electric car maker run by Elon Musk, that we're going to talk about in a moment, also a riser. But as you say, some of the world's biggest offshore wind turbine manufacturers were among those with very sharp falls in their share prices after the president-elect pledged on the campaign trail to halt offshore wind energy projects on day one of a new term in office. Andy Brown is vice chairman of one of those firms, Ørsted, and joins us now. Andy's also the president of the Energy Institute here in the UK. Andy, morning.
Hello, Will. Hi, good morning.
President-elect's been pretty clear, hasn't he? They destroy everything. They're horrible. The most expensive energy there is. They ruin the environment. They kill birds. They kill whales. That was Donald Trump in New Jersey on the campaign trail.
Yeah, look, I think you have to
get past the rhetoric. Obviously, offshore wind is part of the energy transition and part of the mix. The Northeast states have binding commitments for how much renewables they need in their mix. New York, 70% by 2030. So, you know, I think there will be progress still, but obviously it's more difficult times.
There's no question that it's going to get more expensive, though, for companies like you to try and work in the US.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at Ørsted's prime focus actually is the UK. So we have much, much more business in the UK than we have in the US. The two projects we have in the US have all their federal permits in place and now are basically under state control. So those are in a really reasonably good position. So we may have to adjust our focus, but that's how we'll have to look at it.
Is that simply what will happen now, that companies like yours, others, we saw Vestas, one of your competitors, big fall in its share price as well, another wind turbine manufacturer, they just will turn away from the US?
Well, I think, it'll be a focus. I mean, let's get, the US aimed to get to 30 gigawatts by 2030. The UK aims to get to 55 gigawatts. So in terms of the world of offshore wind, the UK is much more relevant than the US.
More broadly, what it means, though, for renewable energy, the president promising to roll back a whole raft of things that affect not just offshore wind, but onshore wind, solar. And this is the biggest economy in the world. Surely that can't be good news for the sector more widely.
No, I think, firstly, it's really bad news for the world. It's bad news to drive the energy transition to mitigate climate change. After the catastrophic floods in Valencia, this is not the news we needed. The world isn't transitioning fast enough. And for such an important player, the leader of that, to have an intention to leave the Paris Climate Accord is very, very bad. And we need unity and not parochial interests. The US is the driver of clean tech. It will cede that to China, possibly now. But under the last Trump government, renewables grew 66%. So let's not, or solar and wind. So let's not say it's just about a pace of change. And there seems to be strong kind of bipartisan support for the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which Biden put in place because of Republican jobs in Republican states. So it's not a completely polarized story.
And just bringing it back to here in the UK, Andy, a point being made by Sam Coates, among others, from Sky News last night, that a lot of policy here that the Labour government has around investments in green energy are kind of cribbed from the Biden administration. And the point Sam Coates and others were making is that's been quite clearly rejected here by voters in the United States. Is that bad news for that policy agenda here?
No, look, I don't think so. I think the UK has a very, very good regulatory framework. This contract for difference is stimulating investment in green energy. The UK is doing really well. I don't think we cribbed off the Democrats. Incentives are good, and the UK government has done well in that.
Andy Brown, Vice Chairman of the wind turbine manufacturer Ørsted and President of the Energy Institute, thanks so much for your time. Well, Tinica Frieker is with us as well. Tinica is the head of UK equity research at the fund manager Waverton. Tinica, morning.
Good morning.
Just whip us through a couple more of those winners and losers, particularly from companies here in the UK, stock market movers, because there were plenty of them yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. So if we maybe sort of start with the positive, so the prospect of financial deregulation clearly drove financials both in the US and the UK, particularly seemed to impact investment banks a lot. So JP Morgan in the US was up 11% and in the UK Barclays was up 5%, and that's sort of the only bank really with a US-based investment bank exposure. And in the flip side, on the negative, I'm sure we're going to talk about tariffs later, but there's sort of companies who make products in the UK and export it to the US. So, Diageo, for example, 40% of their sales are in the US, so they were down about 3%, and we saw that in European names too.
Diageo, big booze manufacturer, spirits in particular, and as we know from the first Trump presidency, spirits and wine, things that certainly had tariffs threatened on them coming from the UK and Europe last time. More from Tinica, as we say, pick through some more of those moves, as she says, around tariffs and potential implications too. But Helen, Fiona Humphrey was talking about some of those potential selections, wasn't she, from Mar-a-Lago that President Trump might make in terms of his cabinet makeup. And one of those may well be the boss of Tesla, the electric car company, because Elon Musk had been pretty high-profile supporter of Donald Trump throughout the campaign, and the feeling appeared mutual.
Let me tell you, we have a new star. A star is born, Elon. Now he is. Now he's an amazing guy.
Peter Bardenfleth Hansen, former senior director of Tesla's Europe, Middle East and Asia arm, now boss of the electric motor firm DG Innovators, with us. Peter, morning.
Morning, Will.
So Elon Musk's promised role, certainly on the campaign trail, was the Department of Government Efficiency, looking to sort of roll back various regulations. Is that a role he's well suited to?
Well, you guys remember the first day of him coming into X, where he had the kitchen sink with him. That's probably really does show what type of man Elon is. And yes, he is Mr. Efficiency when it comes to setting up businesses and making sure that they deliver on their promises, although sometimes it is somewhat further down the line time-wise. But he's a man of no compromise.
What specifically do you think will be in his sights? We heard Nigel Farage on the programme yesterday talking to Justin, saying he thought they would be radical in this area. What might that look like?
Well, I think we're going to be looking at some serious deregulations of various aspects, of particularly within the industries that Elon Musk is involved in. And basically, you know, he's involved in a lot of things. But if we just look at Tesla or SpaceX, for those being top headlines, there's no doubt that his need to be able to deregulate some of the requirements to further his Tesla cyber cabs, for instance, the autonomous variations of that. Those have been hindered by too heavy regulations. I think we're going to see that. We're going to see more focus on government contracts for SpaceX, perhaps even more military contracts, and not least.
Sounds more like a lobbying role than a cabinet job.
I think it will be. I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be under the same headline, you know, trickle-down economics in relation to, you know, we'll be doing this, but this is going to be good for U.S. economy.
What impact on those companies you mentioned, Tesla in particular, do you think?
Well, you can look at the share price. Yesterday it went up, I believe, 12-14% just on this news. But I think this is de facto making Elon probably the most powerful man in the universe.
There's a danger, though, isn't there?
News guard.
There's a danger, isn't there, though, becoming so closely associated with the United States government? An obvious area already is around tariffs that Tinica was just talking about, and China. Very different if you're kind of seen as part of the US government, how a government like China might approach your company and your investments there. And of course, we don't know down the track as well. Is that not a risk?
It definitely is. And it is an interesting conundrum that we got here, because on the one hand, you'll have Trump going very heavy in on tariffs and trade wars and what have you down the line, whereas the liberalism within Elon is very much anti-trade barriers. He wants to reduce them. He wants to make sure that his ability to get rare metals from China and other places in the world to be able to be part of his production machinery needs to be in place. And so there is definitely a contradiction in what these two policies look like.
Peter, thanks so much for your time this morning. Peter Bardenfleth Hansen, their former Tesla Europe boss, now with DG Innovate. Tinica Freak is still with us from Waverton. Tinica, tariffs potentially, we talked about the share price there of Tesla going up, but other car companies, VW, BMW, hit already.
Yeah, no, that's right. So the prospect of maybe 10 to 20% additional tariffs on European cars being sold in the US is not a great prospect. So Mercedes and BMW, we're down 6 to 7%. And as you said, the VW and Porsche down 4%. And it's... it's the potential start
global trade tensions.
Yeah,
and I just wonder, we've obviously got an interest rate decision today from the Bank of England. I'm guessing it's obviously too late for that to factor in a meaningful way, but presumably some of that has been modelled, right, in the decisions we're going to hear today and for the future guidance.
Yeah, possibly not in the decision today, because I think that's linked to the lower inflation, so we're going to get a cut to 4.75%. But yes, but what is the impact of last week's UK budget on UK economic growth in the future and inflation, and what is the impact potentially of from tariffs that Trump might pose? Absolutely.
Sure, plenty of on that decision on the world at 1 o'clock. A little bit later, Tinica Freaker, head of equity at Waverton. Thanks so much for your time.
Will, good to talk, good to hear from you this morning, and more from you after 7 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed. But for now, it's time for Mike Williams and the sport. And Mike, we've got Jimmy Anderson coming in for 7:50 today, and he's got work to do because England have been battered overnight.
Yes, they could have done with a bit of Jimmy's pace out in the Caribbean, because I bring you, Amal, bad news from Barbados this morning, from an England perspective at least, because they were hammered by the West Indies in the deciding one-day international overnight, beaten by 8 wickets with more than 7 overs to spare. It means England lose the 3-match series 2-1. More from Dan Norcross.
The West Indies wrapped up the series decider in Barbados at a canter by 8 wickets with 42 balls to spare. After winning an important toss, they reduced England to 24 for 4 at the end of the power play, and despite a spirited fight back from Phil Salt, Sam Curran, Dan Mosley and Jofra Archer, 263 was never enough on a pitch that became easier to bat as the game progressed. Overton dispatched Evan Lewis early, but thereafter Brandon King with 102 and Casey Carty with an unbeaten 128, his first international century, combined in a quite brilliant second wicket partnership of 209 to dash England's hopes.
We will hear from the England coach, Marcus Trescothick, after that defeat in the next hour of the programme. England's next commitments in the Caribbean is a 5-match T20 series, which starts on Saturday. So a disappointing night for England's cricketers. So too for English clubs in football's Champions League.
There goes the full-time whistle in Belgium, and Aston Villa's 100% record in the Champions League this season comes to an end.
Yes, defeats for Arsenal and Aston Villa last night. Both sides were previously unbeaten in the competition. Arsenal slipped to a 1-0 defeat away to Inter Milan, whilst Aston Villa lost to Club Bruges by the same scoreline, but in altogether more farcical circumstances.
What's the referee given here?
I think he's given handball. Handball against Tyrone Mings for picking it up, because he's deemed the ball was back in play when Martinez touched it.
Well, sometimes you say I've seen everything in football, but I don't think that's ever true.
Yeah, completely bizarre. 10 minutes into the second half with the scores at 0-0, Aston Villa goalkeeper Emi Martinez nudged the ball out of the 6-yard area, and defender Tyrone Mings, who, thinking the goal kick had not been taken, picked up the ball. The referee quickly ran over and awarded a penalty for handball, which Bruges duly scored. The Aston Villa manager Unai Emery afterwards was scathing of the error, calling it the biggest mistake I have witnessed in my career. Finally, boxing, and the British fighter Conor Benn's provisional suspension for a banned substance has been lifted after a 2-year battle with the UK Anti-Doping Agency and the British Board of Boxing Control. The unbeaten welterweight twice tested positive in 2022, but the ban has been withdrawn after UCAD said that they were not completely satisfied that Benn had knowingly committed an anti-doping violation.
Mike, thank you. Next week, Zoe Kleiman looks at a challenging job for our digital age.
I'm Zoe Kleinman, the BBC's technology editor, and in this new series for Radio 4, I meet the moderators trying to manage the worst excesses of the internet.
The content sticks with you. The hardest part of content moderation, in my view, is the images of things that have really happened.
And explore the impact this job has on those who do it.
Sometimes after even just a few weeks or months of viewing this content day in, day in and out, they started to develop long-term mental health consequences.
The Moderators with me, Zoe Kleinman. Next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now the time is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. and Amal Rajan here in London. And now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team says the United States president-elect will begin selecting his cabinet in the days and weeks to come. Mr. Trump is said to be looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House shortly to discuss a smooth transition of power after his historic win over Kamala Harris. He'll take office in January. Last night, Ms. Harris formally admitted defeat. She told cheering supporters in Washington, D.C. that while she conceded this election, she did not concede the fight that fueled her campaign. Downing Street has said that the Prime Minister has spoken to Donald Trump and offered hearty congratulations after his election victory. A statement said Sakir Starmer looked forward to working closely with Mr. Trump across all areas of the special relationship. Separately, Sakir will today sign new agreements with Serbia, North Macedonia and Kosovo to intercept criminal gangs smuggling migrants through the Western Balkans. The deals will be announced in Budapest at a meeting of the European political community. There have been loud explosions in the south of Lebanon's capital, Beirut, an hour after the Israeli army told residents of four districts to evacuate. Israel says it hit Hezbollah command centres and weapons stores. Earlier, Lebanese health officials said that 55 people had been killed by Israeli bombing in the eastern Barbek Hermen region. The Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner has suggested that new council homes, which the government has promised to build in England, will be exempt from the right to buy scheme. Since the 1980s, tenants living in such properties can purchase them at a discount. That has led to criticism that the stock of social housing is being depleted. Ms. Rayner says existing tenants won't be affected, but there will be different rules for new council homes. And the Conservative politician Sir John Knott, who was the Defence Secretary at the time of the Falklands War, has died. He was 92. Sir John played a key role in Lady Thatcher's war cabinet when the UK recaptured the islands from Argentina in 1982.
Thank you, Alan. It is 25 to 7. Donald Trump is going to go to the White House soon, that courtesy extended by Joe Biden, who is also going to address the nation today. Let's talk to Jess Parker, our correspondent here in Washington, D.C. Do we know what he's going to say, Jess, or indeed any more detail about this visit?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly what Joe Biden is going to say, just that he is, as you mentioned, going to address the nation mid-morning time here, say mid-afternoon in the UK, and this visit from Donald Trump, we're told, will happen shortly. It's the first time we'll really have heard from the sitting president, the outgoing president, since Donald Trump won. And of course, Joe Biden is the guy who pulled out of this race reluctantly, who's now watching his party, the Democratic Party, in disarray after this huge loss to a man they regard as a threat to democracy. And he'll invite Joe, we'll have Donald Trump to the White House, but he may now also, over the coming years, have to watch the undoing of his legacy in several areas by Donald Trump, whether that's green initiatives, whether that's economic policy, whether that's his policy abroad on Ukraine. And for Donald Trump, as he eyes going back into the White House, the Republicans have taken the Senate. They're hopeful of retaining the House. He's won the popular vote. This time around, Donald Trump really knows his way around the White House. So for him, he is arguably going to be more powerful and more able to exercise his agenda than ever before.
Yeah, on the subject of the House of Representatives, we don't know yet, do we, what the outcome is going to be, as you were saying, but there are suggestions that it could be that clean sweep, which really would make Donald Trump a very powerful president in his second term.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, we don't have the final results of the House of Representatives, but Republicans, looking at the numbers and the projections, are hopeful of retaining control there. And as I mentioned, they've taken control as well of the Senate. So it does put him in a really powerful position, because also not only that, he will go into the White House with a conservative-leaning Supreme Court as well. And then you look at his policies that he wants to enact, mass deportations, deregulation, ending the Ukraine war as well. These are big changes for America and for the world. And look, they may sound like simple policies. There will be huge complications within them for Donald Trump. So, for example, mass deportations, people would expect that he will face legal battles on them. But certainly he goes in a really powerful position. I think it's interesting, though, you know, he has these hardcore supporters who back him. But there will be those people, of course, who voted for him this time who have a bit more of a transactional relationship with Donald Trump, and they will want to see him deliver on the things that he has promised them.
And meanwhile, for Joe Biden, you mentioned him earlier, I mean, real anger, actually, in the Democratic Party being aimed increasingly at him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is now clearly going to be an extensive, months-long, maybe longer, post-mortem for the Democrats about what went wrong. And different people will have different opinions. But I think certainly some people are taking aim at Joe Biden. This question about whether he hung on too long, didn't face the reality that maybe he was going to need to step down, and then handed over to Kamala Harris too late in the day, not giving her long enough to establish herself. But then, look, other people will say Kamala Harris in her campaign didn't do enough to separate herself from Joe Biden, make herself distinct from her boss, and therefore be able to offer some sort of path to change. But I think this period of introspection for the Democratic Party is going to be long, and it's going to be painful, and they've got time to do it, haven't they?
Indeed they have. Jess Parker, thank you.
Well, let's turn to UK politics now, because the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, spoke to the US, or actually rather the next US president. He's not president yet, it's not until the inauguration. But he spoke to Donald Trump last night, and we've had a bit of a readout of what they said. Hannah Miller, our political correspondent, can take us through it. Morning, Hannah. What do we know about that chat?
Well, Downing Street are certainly on a bit of a charm offensive, Amal. We're told that the Prime Minister offered his hearty congratulations to Donald Trump, and that the leaders fondly recalled their first meeting. Fond and hearty aren't necessarily normal words to find in diplomatic circles and in readouts like this. They really speak to Downing Street's desire to have a good relationship with Donald Trump. They say that the two leaders agreed that the UK and the US had a strong relationship on things like defence, security, growth and prosperity. Frankly, those are all things where Donald Trump's policies could have an impact on the UK. The call also mentioned the Middle East, we're told, and Downing Street are trying to make something of President-elect Trump's close connections and affinity to the United Kingdom. I think with all of this, it's going to be a case of seeing what Trump actually does when he gets into office.
Slightly tricky thing for Labour is, well, it's two things. One is Rachel Reeves has pursued an economic policy pretty close to the Bidenomics, which has just lost in America, partly because it didn't deliver rising living standards. But also, Labour cabinet ministers seem to have said a number of quite fruity things about Mr. Trump in previous lives.
Yeah, and the new leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, wasted no time in highlighting those things. Certainly the comments made by the now Foreign Secretary David Lammy at Prime Minister's Questions yesterday, trying to make that as awkward as it possibly could be. I think Downing Street clearly are trying to move on from those comments. Keir Starmer's team have been conscious of the possibility of a Donald Trump win for many months now, and have been cautioning Labour MPs about what they should say. I think on the sort of Bidenomics point, the feeling here is that Rachel Reeves's policies really need to work. The sort of lesson from America is that people need to feel better off, and like public services are improving, the way that political fortunes can really be impacted by the global economy. So I think this does kind of reflect on, you know, the need to connect with concerns and deliver, but it's not necessarily going to kind of change what the UK does in that sense.
And I'll put some of that to Pat McFadden, actually, who we're going to be speaking to a little bit later in the programme. Hannah, for now, thank you. Hannah Miller.
18 minutes to 7, and the Trump theme continues, because the collapse of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's ruling coalition has thrown Germany into some disarray, and that disarray, Mr. Schultz says, needs to be sorted in part because of Donald Trump's election. Let's talk to Damian McGuinness, our correspondent in Berlin. Do we understand, Damian, what the timing of all of this is now?
Yeah, so the next step, Justin, will be a vote of confidence in the German parliament on January 15th. That is likely to lead to fresh elections, early elections, by the end of March. Ordinarily, Germany would go to the polls at the end of September. So this is a big shift. It was a really dramatic day in Germany yesterday. German voters woke up to the news that Donald Trump had won the election, something which is going to be really difficult for Germany. They went to bed with the news that their own governing coalition had fallen apart. And I think we have expected something to happen, particularly this week. The last year, the rows have been really growing between the three very different parties within this governing coalition. The last few days were full of crisis meetings. And then late last night, the Chancellor delivered a remarkable speech, a scathing attack on his own finance minister, something unprecedented really in modern recent German politics. He called him irresponsible and egotistical because he said the finance minister was not prepared to compromise. And of course, the main issue is money. It's all about how to balance the budget. And the rows that have been growing within the coalition essentially show that the coalition has been falling in two opposing directions. On one side, Chancellor Scholz with his centre-left Social Democrats, supported by his partner Greens, and they want to loosen the very strict constitutional debt rules, take on new debt, in part to help Ukraine and to get the economy going. On the other side, the third party in this very uncomfortable coalition, the free market liberal FDP party, led by the finance minister, Christian Lindner, they want to cut taxes, cut welfare, exactly the opposite approach. So we're now seeing that these two completely opposing ideological positions are in fact incompatible, and that's why it's been impossible for this government to stay together.
Damon McGuinness in Berlin, thank you.
16 minutes to 7. Well, Hannah Miller mentioned it a moment ago. Yesterday, the news from United States and Donald Trump's re-election provided the backdrop to Kemi Badenoch's debut at Prime Minister's Questions. The new Conservative leader challenged Sir Keir Starmer over his party's attitude to Donald Trump, as our parliamentary correspondent Sean Curran now reports.
Conservative MPs let out a great cheer when their new leader arrived in the Commons for Prime Minister's Questions. The former Prime Minister Theresa May and the ex-Chancellor Norman Lamont looked on from the Peers Gallery as Kemi Badenoch took her seat and waved at her husband Hamish, who was sitting in the Visitors Gallery in front of her. At noon, the Commons Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, got to his feet.
Can I first of all welcome the Leader of the Opposition? Yeah. I wish you well as Leader of the Opposition.
But it's the Prime Minister who gets the first and last word at PMQs, and Sir Keir Starmer began by congratulating Donald Trump on his election victory.
As the closest of allies, the UK and US will continue to work together to protect our shared values of freedom and democracy.
There were more Conservative cheers and a single Labour shout of resign when Kemi Badenoch stood up to ask her first question. She too congratulated President-elect Trump and noted that the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy met him in September.
Did the Foreign Secretary take that opportunity to apologise for making derogatory and scatological references, including, and I quote, Trump is not only a woman-hating, neo-Nazi sympathising sociopath, he is also a profound threat to the international order. And if he did not apologise, will the Prime Minister do so now on his behalf?
Yeah. Sir Keir didn't talk about David Lammy's comments.
The Foreign Secretary and I did meet President-elect Trump just a few weeks ago for dinner for about a couple of hours, and we discussed a number of issues of global significance. It was a very constructive exercise.
The Conservative leader then asked the Prime Minister to invite President Trump to speak to MPs and peers.
Will the Prime Minister show that he and his government can be more than student politicians by asking you, Mr. Speaker, to extend an invitation to President Trump to address Parliament on his next visit?
Yeah. Yeah. The Leader of the Opposition is giving a masterclass on student politics. Mr. Speaker, we live in probably a more volatile world than we've lived in for many decades. It is absolutely crucial that we have a strong relationship, that strong special relationship forged in difficult circumstances between the US and the UK.
As the noisy exchanges continued, Kemi Badenoch accused the Prime Minister of reading out scripted lines that his officials had prepared for him. Labour MPs retaliated when she turned to the plan announced in the budget to introduce a 20% inheritance tax on farms valued at more than £1 million.
I am very clear that we would reverse Labour's cruel family farms tax. What can he say now to reassure the farming community who provides security for the whole nation?
That question was punctuated by loud shouts of reading from Labour MPs. That's a bit of a throwback to an earlier parliamentary age when it certainly wasn't the done thing for an MP to read out a question, and culprits would either be told off by the Speaker or face the jeers of their opponents. Sir Keir Starmer offered to help the new leader of the opposition.
If she's going to complain about scripted answers, it's probably best not to read that from a script.
He insisted the vast majority of farmers wouldn't be affected by the change. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, congratulated Kemi Badenoch on becoming the first black leader of a UK-wide party. He said it was a major and historic achievement. But unlike the Conservative leader and the Prime Minister, he didn't congratulate Donald Trump.
President-elect Trump praised Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And he quotes, he called it genius. He also said he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want to NATO allies.
He feared a Trump presidency would be a huge threat to global security and the UK's national security. The Prime Minister said the Commons was united about Ukraine and clear about Russian aggression. And he repeated that he was looking forward to working with President-elect Trump to make sure the UK had a special relationship with the US.
Well, that was Sean Curran reporting, and you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio.
Time now is 10 to 7. In the middle of election night here in America, Scott Jennings, a Republican political adviser turned TV pundit, said something on CNN that caught the attention of many in the nation. He called Donald Trump's election the revenge of the working class, and he fulminated against the political and media figures who he said had been holding conversations about the campaign that had ignored that class. When I caught up with him, we began with the revenge.
Well, I think there's a lot of people in this country, working class Americans, you know, just the average everyday people who get up and go to work. And, you know, you got to remember, they've been crushed for the last few years. They were crushed by COVID. Then they were crushed by inflation. And a lot of them are, you know, they're not progressive. They're not liberal. They feel like they've been crushed in their values. And they told us they've had enough. And this country moved to the right from the 22 election, from the 2020 election. We just had a movement to the right. And it was led by these working class Americans who told the elites in this country, we've had enough and we need to get back to normal. I think the mandate for Trump, honestly, is just to make America normal again. And it's obvious to me that's what they're begging for.
And yet, of course, the political conversation in the last week or so that I've witnessed here has been about a joke made by a comedian about Puerto Rico, has been about all sorts of other things, in a sense. And I mean, is it relevant that the political conversation seems so removed from what you've just described?
Well, I do think the political information complex in this country, which is fueled by the news media, plus the political parties, you know, plus the other, you know, the institutions that kind of dominate and have the capacity to set our national conversations, they're totally disconnected from the people that just elected Donald Trump. There needs to be a reckoning for that. And we do need a robust, trusted free press in this country. But I think that there has to be a reckoning about why it is that half the country is so disconnected from the people who, you know, are ostensibly in charge with kind of telling us what's going on and setting the contours of our political conversations. If you watch the news in the United States for the last week, all you would have heard about is Puerto Rico, this poll out of Iowa, which turned out to be wildly inaccurate. And I think they were trying to, some people were trying to will into existence a political reality that just didn't exist.
Quite ironic to suggest that that they're willing into an existence a reality that doesn't exist. Because, of course, one of the accusations that they level broadly at Trump supporters is that they live in a world that isn't real.
Yeah, well, he won and they lost. And the reality that the Republicans and their supporters are living in is quite bleak. The inflation has crushed households. If you look at the exit polls, 3/4 of Americans have said they've suffered severe hardships or moderate, at least, hardships.
How convinced are you that Trump will do the things now that those people want him to do?
Oh, I think he will want to do them. I am worried about the political system in Washington once again not accepting it. You know, there was an article in the New York Times back in June about a whole bunch of outside groups forming up strategies to try to prevent Donald Trump from being able to do anything if he were to take office. So here you have a president that's gotten more than 50% of the vote, and there's already this resistance forming to him and an effort to try to stop him from governing at all. Now, how do you think the people who voted for him are going to react to that? What I'm hoping for is peace. I think what the American people want is peace. Can we give this man and his administration and his party a couple of years to try to execute their program? Can we just have a couple of years where we try to just have an election and the people who win get to try to run their program? I think that's what most Americans want, and honestly, that's what he deserved, because I don't think he got that opportunity the first time around.
Scott Jennings, thank you very much.
Time now, really interesting that. Time now is 7:07. A leading British scientist has landed one of the biggest jobs in global science. Professor Mark Thompson is the next Director General of CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, and he joins us now. Professor Thompson, good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations. I should tell our listeners that it is at CERN, which they'll have heard of, that you can find the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, which is the world's largest and most powerful particle accelerator. It's at a particularly interesting moment, isn't it, in its long and beautiful mission to discover the essence of the universe. What do you want to do with the job?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there are two prime goals. First, as you just mentioned, the Large Hadron Collider is the world's preeminent infrastructure for unraveling the mysteries of the universe. And at the moment, we're going through the stage of actually upgrading it, making it more powerful. So in many ways, we're right at the beginning of the journey of discovery for the Large Hadron Collider. And my first priority will be completing that and actually bringing that into operation as soon as possible, because it's such an exciting machine. It will deliver more data. But actually, the other thing that's exciting is our scientists are becoming more imaginative, adopting advanced technologies like artificial intelligence. So the data we take in the future is going to be even more powerful than the data we have now. So huge discovery opportunities. The second priority is all of these very large infrastructures. The Large Hadron Collider is 27 kilometers in circumference, take a long time to plan, to construct. And we're now looking at what happens after the Large Hadron Collider. So in the next 5 years during my mandate, one of the highest priorities is really to converge on what comes after the Large Hadron Collider. And that really is a question of what are the big scientific questions we want to address and what is the right machine to do that. The prime candidate is something we currently call the Future Circular Collider, which is about three times as large as the Large Hadron Collider.
Very, very exciting. But I should explain, Professor Thompson, for those of our distinguished listeners who aren't complete particle physics geeks like you, and to some extent me, that what you're trying to do essentially is you're trying to bash particles. You're trying to use this distance, 27 kilometres, to accelerate particles, because if you bash them into each other with sufficient speed and vigour, you can reveal something about the essence of what is inside them. And therefore, you can reveal the discovery of particles like the Higgs boson, which is the particle that helps us understand why some elementary particles have mass. What would success look like from your mandate, from your 5 years, in terms of getting us to a better understanding of what's inside the atom?
No, I think you're absolutely right. The essence of what we do at CERN, put crudely, is smash particles together as hard as we can to create conditions that existed shortly after the Big Bang. And in that way, we explore the building blocks of the universe. As I say, I think the thing that really excites me in terms of the science that we'll be delivering in the next 5 years is the opportunity not only to measure the properties of the Higgs boson using the Large Hadron Collider, but also to explore the unknown. As I say, we are going to have a more powerful machine, more data, better techniques. There really are exciting discovery opportunities here. Now, of course, with discoveries, you don't actually know what you're going to discover. Otherwise, they wouldn't really be discoveries. So I think the real excitement for me is that opportunity. We're taking a leap into the unknown. We don't know what we'll find, but I'm really excited about the chance of actually finding something completely unexpected. So that would really be my biggest hope in the next 5 years.
Professor Mark Thompson, next Director General of CERN. I think you take the job up in 2026, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Well, I hope you'll come back. And just very, very briefly, final thought, I should say, what's your assessment of how CERN has done over the past few years?
I mean, I think CERN has been a fantastically successful organisation. The mission at the moment really is to understand this very strange particle we discovered, the Higgs boson, make the measurements of the properties of the Higgs boson. Is it what we think it is? Does it look like and behave like what we expect it to? We're making massive progress at a really, really exciting time.
Wonderful. Professor Mark Thompson, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
What have we got?
On BBC iPlayer.
All I know is somebody's behind all this.
You can just walk away.
You should investigate. I got the
blues. These aren't crime dramas.
What the hell are you playing at?
They're a break from your work dramas.
How does all this make you feel?
Well done, everybody.
Dead and Buried, Line of Duty, Luther, and loads more.
We're throwing you a lifeline here, mate.
Whoever you are, whatever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
And now, 2 minutes to seven, here's the weather with Simon King.
Hi, Emil. Thank you. Good morning. You may have noticed that it's incredibly mild out there this morning, especially if you're in Northern Ireland and northwest Scotland. Temperature's currently about 17 degrees in northwest Scotland. It should be about 2 Celsius at this time of year. So, yeah, way above average. But we, again, have a lot of cloud, some mist and some fog out there this morning. And there's going to be very little change, really, into the afternoon. But let's give it a go for southwest England and Wales. The mist and fog will tend to lift up. And while it'll be fairly cloudy, we will see the breeze picking up a touch, and that will just help break the cloud up towards the west of Wales and parts of southwest England. So you may see some brighter skies, a bit of sunshine developing here, and maximum temperatures getting up to about 11 to 16 degrees. In southeast England, eastern England and the Midlands, again, some mist and some pretty overcast conditions. Mist will lift up. It will stay cloudy into the afternoon, highs of 12 to 15 Celsius. Across northern England, thick, low cloud, some mist and a bit of drizzle. The mist will lift, the drizzle will stop, but it'll stay cloudy and temperatures will get to about 9 to 12 Celsius. Across Northern Ireland, a very mild start today, some mist, some murk, cloud, but breezy again, so we may just see that cloud break up a touch into the afternoon, highs of 14, 15 Celsius. And across Scotland, very mild start towards the northwest, northeast Scotland, with some clear skies, a bit chillier, and that's where we'll have some sunshine again through today. Elsewhere across Scotland, fairly cloudy, and temperatures of 14 to 16 Celsius.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4, the Mole Rajan and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 7th of November. The headlines this morning: President-elect Trump is preparing to choose his cabinet after his team announced he'd meet Joe Biden to ensure a smooth transition of power. Downing Street says the Keir Starmer offered Donald Trump hearty congratulations during a phone call when the two discussed thriving relations between Britain and America. Over the next hour, we'll be looking at Donald Trump's agenda, both at home and abroad, and who might form his new team.
He's coming in with this misfit coalition that helped him get across the finish line on election night, that when you actually have to go into government and marry some of these tensions and square these circles, it is really hard to envision how that gets done.
Also coming up in the next hour, why this year, 2024, is on track to be the first year to break through a symbolic climate change mark. And Jimmy Anderson, England's most successful bowler in Test cricket, will be joining us live at 10 to 8. Prepare for me, for the whole team, to be bowled over. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team has said that the US president-elect is preparing to select his cabinet less than 24 hours after his dramatic political comeback. Mr. Trump is said to be looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power after he beat Kamala Harris yesterday. Joe Biden is due to make a televised address this afternoon. Our correspondent Neda Tofik reports from Florida, where Mr. Trump's team is based.
Donald Trump's transition team says that in the coming days, he will be selecting the best people to join his administration to make the lives of Americans affordable, safe, and secure. A visit to the White House is expected to take place in the near future after Joe Biden called to congratulate the president-elect on his victory and extended an invitation to the Oval Office to ensure a smooth transition. It's a courtesy Donald Trump did not afford Mr. Biden 4 years ago when he lost the election. A tone of civility between political rivals is holding for now, with Mr. Trump's spokesperson saying that he appreciated Joe Biden's call. Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, who has kept a low profile in recent years, also released a statement. She said the new administration would safeguard the heart of the republic, freedom. And she said she anticipated citizens would rise above ideology for the sake of individual liberty, economic prosperity, and security.
Kamala Harris conceded the election to Mr. Trump yesterday evening in a speech on the steps of Howard University in Washington, where she'd been a student. President Biden hailed her as a public servant full of integrity, courage and character. Our correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Washington.
It was a speech that no politician wants to give. Kamala Harris said she would ensure that there was a peaceful transition of power. She added that it was a fundamental principle of democracy that when one side lost an election, they accepted the results, referring to Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the result of 2020. The vice president told her supporters that it may feel like dark times, but they should continue the fight.
While I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign. The fight for freedom, for opportunity, for fairness, and the dignity of all people.
The Harris campaign was depending on women voters to tip the election in their favor, but they weren't even able to match the number of women won by President Biden in 2020. Now Ms. Harris becomes the second female presidential candidate to lose to Mr. Trump. It is a time of reckoning for Democrats, leaving them to consider how the party rebuilds from here.
Sir Keir Starmer has spoken to Donald Trump to congratulate him on his victory. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
In his phone call, Sir Keir offered Donald Trump what a Downing Street spokesperson described as hearty congratulations for an historic victory. The two men may be far apart politically, but they apparently spoke fondly about their meeting in New York in September when the Prime Minister had dinner with the then presidential candidate to try to start preparing the ground in case he won. Sir Keir's spokesperson said on their call the two agreed that the relationship between the UK and the US was incredibly strong and would continue to thrive.
Sir Keir will be among European leaders who will discuss the impact of Donald Trump's victory on Ukraine at a summit in Hungary. Our Europe editor Katja Adler is at the meeting in Budapest.
Donald Trump will be the main focus of today's meeting. What his return to the White House might mean in terms of trade tariffs, China policy, European security, and perhaps most urgently, the future of Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Budapest. He remarked that US leadership is vital for a just peace after speaking to Donald Trump yesterday. But the fear here is the new US administration will slow, if not stop, the flow of American military aid to Kyiv. Donald Trump has boasted in the past he could end the war with Russia in a day. What isn't clear is whether he wants Ukraine to win.
Germany's three-party coalition has collapsed after ministers from the Free Democrats quit the government. The exit follows a decision by the Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, to sack his finance minister, Christian Lindner, the Free Democrat leader. Mr. Scholz announced a vote of confidence would be held in January, which could lead to early elections. Damian McGuinness reports from Berlin.
For months, the arguments have been growing louder within the German government, mainly over how to balance the budget. Chancellor Scholz wants to boost spending with new debt. The finance minister opposed this and wanted to cut taxes too. This unusual coalition of centre-left Social Democrats, Greens and free market liberals was always going to be tricky. When it formed 3 years ago, there was enough money to paper over the cracks. But then Russia invaded Ukraine, energy prices shot up, and Germany had to boost spending on defence. The prospect of a Trump presidency is now adding to the sense of urgency that Germany needs a strong and united government to kickstart the economy.
Several large airstrikes have hit the southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital early this morning, an hour after the Israeli army told residents to leave. There were no immediate reports of casualties. Earlier, Lebanon's health ministry said at least 40 people had been killed yesterday during Israeli bombing in the east of the country. Our correspondent Joe Inwood is monitoring events from Jerusalem.
Israel's campaign against Hezbollah shows no sign of slowing. This was Beirut overnight, the sky lit up by huge explosions. Israel says it hit Hezbollah command centers and weapon stores. There were attacks too in the Bekaa Valley, with 16 killed in the village of Nasriya and 11 in Baalbek City. According to the Lebanese Minister of Culture, the strike severely damaged the Ottoman-era Manshia building. Mohammed Mortada said it was an irredeemable loss for Lebanon and for world heritage.
Metropolitan Police has sent a file of evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service to consider bringing charges against the former Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood. The 66-year-old was accused of non-recent sexual abuse allegations, which he has previously denied. And the Conservative politician Sir John Knott, who was Defence Secretary at the time of the Falklands invasion, has died. He was 92. Sir John played a key role in Lady Thatcher's war cabinet, but is also remembered for losing his temper during a TV interview. Will Vernon looks back at his life.
When Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands in 1982, Sir John Knott offered his resignation to the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher. But she turned it down, despite accusations that Sir John failed to anticipate the capture of the islands. In fact, his shortcomings were rather more serious than that. He later admitted that he wasn't even sure where the Falklands were and had to consult a globe in his office at the Ministry of Defence. After the conflict was over, he retired from politics and received his knighthood. But Sir John will also be remembered for storming out of a live interview with the BBC presenter Sir Robin Day on Newsnight in 1982.
Why should the public on this issue, as regards the future of the Royal Navy, believe you, a transient, here today and, if I may say so, gone tomorrow politician, rather than a senior officer of many years?
I'm fed up with this interview, really. It's such a ridiculous Royal Navy.
Thank you, Mr. Knott.
The former Defence Secretary, it seems, didn't hold a grudge against Sir Robin for very long, as he later called his memoirs Here Today, Gone Tomorrow, in tribute to his TV tantrum.
That report was from Will Vernon.
And it brings us to 9 minutes past seven. What does the coming Trump presidency mean for Ukraine and for the Middle East? We are a long way from knowing for sure, but I've been talking first to our international editor, Jeremy Byrne, about the way leaders in the Middle East might respond to the fact of the Trump victory.
Well, I think the big thing about Trump is that people don't really know, because it's his unpredictability that they're all trying to factor in at the moment. I thought this welter of posts on social media, on X, a.k.a. Twitter, that we have seen in the last, 24 hours or so, is remarkable, because they're all, I think, trying to transpose onto President-elect Trump the things that they want to happen. Now, Netanyahu, for example, Israel's prime minister, congratulated him, said it was one of the great, historical political comebacks, because what Netanyahu would like Trump to do is to give him as much latitude as he can in terms of pursuing his own agenda in the Middle East. But I think that might be a little bit different, because I think you can make a very coherent argument right now to say that President Biden has become, well, almost powerless in the face of the way that Mr. Netanyahu has been setting the agenda as far as the progress of the war is concerned, as the way that he responds to the bits of advice he gets from President Biden, essentially, if he wants to, pretty much ignoring it, particularly when it comes to Gaza. And I think it might be different with Donald Trump, because Donald Trump doesn't like people doing things when he asks them not to do it, when he tells them not to. So I think he's going to have his own agenda, and he might be able to impose his agenda in a way that Biden doesn't.
One thing supporters of Donald Trump have said repeatedly during the course of the campaign is that his personality is itself, in a sense, a tool of foreign policy. So when there is a crisis, when something happens, when pressure needs to be put on by America, the fact of Donald Trump being Donald Trump helps. In the Middle East, does it?
Well, I think that the problem with the Middle East since he was last president is that it's really changed. The problems have deepened, have intensified. Some of the artifice around them has been stripped away into the fundamental arguments. And I think the big test for Trump, Mark II, in the Middle East is going to be what happens when a crisis starts, what happens when America cannot set the pace, what happens when it has to respond. What if, for example, the Iranians decide they want to hit Israel again with ballistic missiles? What if then the Israelis say, right, we're going to hit back at the Iranian nuclear targets? Trump is known to be someone who does not want to go to war with Iran. He does not want to be part of a much wider war in the region. How does he slow the process down? Can he find the levers that would do that? sometimes just being bluff and loud and noisy and bullying, knowing that you're backed by this enormous military machine, that might not be enough. That's going to be the big test, I think.
That was Jeremy Byrne, our international editor, talking about the Middle East. Let us turn from the Middle East to another war zone, in a sense, to Europe, with the European leaders gathering, actually, today in Brussels, in Budapest, to survey the new world. We are joined by Peter Altmaier, former chief of staff to Angela Merkel and, indeed, German Minister of Finance. Mr. Altmaier, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Can we think first about Ukraine? In this period up to Donald Trump taking over in January, is there something that Joe Biden ought to be doing and that the European leaders ought to be asking him to do that would alter the situation in Ukraine?
Well, first of all, Mr. Biden and his administration have promised a lot of military support that has not yet been delivered to Ukraine. And I have no doubt that all the European leaders would appreciate if this would be done before inauguration in late January. Second thing, Ukraine has been a European challenge from the beginning. But of course, as always in NATO, we had to rely on American support and cooperation. And this is something that Mr. Trump will make very clear. I don't expect him throwing Ukraine under the bus. He is no interested in surrendering to Mr. Putin, but he has always had a very clear vision that this is a European conflict and that it is up to Europe, to European Union, to European branch of NATO dealing with it. So the heads of states and government in Brussels today will face the challenge to discuss what to do if Mr. Trump expects and requires the stronger participation of Europe. And the second thing is we have a kind of an unhappy disaster in Germany because the coalition government collapsed yesterday night in a moment where Europe is facing its biggest challenge. That means Germany will probably not have a clear, stable and reliable government before late spring. And I see it as a consequence that the cooperation between the British Prime Minister and the French President within the Western and European part of NATO will have to be reinforced and enhanced. We are partners in NATO, no longer in European Union, but in NATO still. This is something where many people in Germany also would be happy if we would see more leadership from these two big countries. There is a special...
I suppose, just on that, sorry to interrupt, just on that, how realistic is that? You're saying that France and the United Kingdom have to take the lead now when it comes to Ukraine and more widely pulling Europe together when it comes to facing up to Russia. Are you hopeful that can happen?
Well, first of all, of course, you need the consent of Germany, of Poland, of many other countries, Italy, Spain, Baltic countries. But the UK has always been very proud of its special relationship with the US. And I'm old enough to remember when Donald Trump was president, he always managed to have what he called a good chemistry with French President Emmanuel Macron. I do not know whether this still exists, but perhaps it is a chance, and I cannot see any other coherent representation of the European part of NATO vis-a-vis Donald Trump. And I foresee very important and very tough talks ahead of all of us. And therefore, right, Europe needs to speak with one voice. And that means we have to put our hopes to a certain extent on the UK and on France as well.
Mm. Peter Altmaier, former chief of staff to Angela Merkel. Thank you very much.
17 minutes past seven. And straight after this programme, Justin and I are going to be joining Nick for a live episode of the Today podcast to answer your questions about what it's like to report on such a momentous election. Justin's been rather busy with our producers over in America. You'll be able to hear that on the live news stream on BBC Sounds. If you just go to the dial across the top, you can find it if you toggle to the right. You can also send us a question. So please do send us your questions. We'll try and answer them after 9 o'clock this morning. The WhatsApp number is +44 330 123 4346, +44 330 123 4346, or you can email us on today@bbc.co.uk. So your questions for Justin, Nick and I, and answered live just after 9 o'clock on the Today podcast. Let's turn to the implications of Trump's re-election for UK politics now, because Kemi Badenoch led the Conservatives in Parliament for Prime Minister's questions yesterday, having appointed her shadow cabinet. And a key figure in it is the shadow chancellor, Mel Stride, who joins us now. Mr Stride, good morning and congratulations on your appointment.
Good morning, Amal, and thank you.
What should British Conservatism, what do you learn from President Trump's re-election?
Well, I think that the economy matters. That seems to have been one of the overriding, along with migration, one of the overriding factors here. And of course, what we've seen in our country is an extraordinary budget that will take us several steps backwards in terms of bringing in very high levels of taxation, which were not spoken about by the Labour Party during the run-up to the general election, landing particularly on the shoulders of those parts of the economy we're going to require to provide the growth, for example, employers' national insurance increases, that tax on jobs, but also a huge spending splurge, particularly in the early years of the forecast, which is going to lead the OBR shows to increased inflationary pressures, higher interest rates for longer. And an economy that's not going to grow, in fact, is going to be growing more slowly than the OBR were forecasting back in the spring when we were in power. So I think the lesson is about is, economics.
Yeah. It's interesting you make the distinction there between growth, the macroeconomic numbers, and you mentioned inflation. Because in America, actually, what's interesting is overall, at a national level, the American economy is humming. Lots of jobs, lots of growth. But it's not filtering down to people's living standards, and they don't feel better off for themselves and their families. That's the key point, isn't it? It's about how people feel for their families, whether or not they feel in real terms better off, not whether the national economy is soaring.
Yes, and this is why, if you look at what the OBR are saying on living standards, for example,
in this
household disposable income, as economists call it, that is effectively across the forecast going in the wrong direction compared to where we were back in the spring when we were in power. And I think it's the Joseph Rowntree Foundation who has said that by October 29, in fact, the average family will be about £770 in real terms worse off than they are today. So the government has gone about this in completely the wrong way. Budgets, as everything in politics, are about choices. And the choice that they have chosen to make is to ramp up taxes, particularly on the productive parts of the economy. This has come through in lower growth than we would have been expecting back in the spring. And I'm afraid at least it's more vulnerable, Amal, to things like changes in the world economic scene and pressures that may come down the line as a consequence.
Well, you know that
because of the choices the government's taken.
You know that what they would say is that what leaves this country vulnerable is the fiscal inheritance that you've left them. Before we go into that, because we've done that in some detail, let's talk about what's in the news this morning, if you don't mind, which is the re-election of Donald Trump. And he has said, and of course this doesn't mean it will necessarily happen, but he has said he may put tariffs of 10 to 20% on imported goods, including from this country. How would you respond to that if you were Chancellor?
So the first and most important thing is America is a hugely important ally, and we need to make sure that we have a very firm and good relationship with the Trump administration. Now, of course, this government has not got off onto the best start in that respect in terms of some of the comments that have been made by members of the government front bench. But it is primarily about relationships. But you're absolutely right. 10 to 20% tariffs. We have over £300 billion worth of exports to the United States, our most important trading partner. So it's important that we get that relationship right.
Yeah, what would you do? What would you do? Because what Kemi Badenoch said to the Prime Minister yesterday is, and I quote, she said, discuss, chat. The Prime Minister has no plans whatsoever for building on the special relationship. So in practical terms, what specifically would you do, were you Chancellor, to respond to those tariffs? if introduced?
Well, I think I've already made an important point, which is when we talk about chat, 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 some of the chat, of course, has been making some very derogatory remarks.
That's
about the
Labour
President
Party, Mr. Strauss. Yes, I'm saying that all the time.
We need a change in tone and approach to Donald Trump, and hopefully this government can now.
Yeah, Keir Starmer and David Lammy have had dinner with him, and it was all very convivial. How would you respond to tariffs of 10 to 20%?
Because this is subject to negotiations and discussions, and the most important thing is that we forge a strong, positive relationship with the Trump administration going forward, and that is exactly what Kemi was referring to yesterday in Prime Minister's Questions.
Yeah, but what would you do about the tariffs?
You have to have discussions. At the end of the day, as a sovereign nation, the United States will take decisions on those kind of matters, but they will clearly make them in conjunction with discussions with other countries, including those within the European Union, for example, and ourselves. And it's important that in that context, we do whatever we can to make sure that those relationships, that the mood music, that the relationships with the administration are strong and positive. And as I say, I do think it's material, the fact that this government has ended up in a position where, it is in a difficult position already with the Trump administration based on the comments that have been made.
Yes, and that's why
Kemi was quite right yesterday to call for those comments to be withdrawn and for an apology to be made.
And I'll put some of those to Labour as soon as we get the chance. Mel Stride, Shadow Chancellor, thank you very much indeed, and look forward to lots more discussions with you in this new role.
And at 10 past 8, we'll be hearing from a Republican congressman who will talk about the relationship with Britain and indeed the relationship he wants to have with the Conservative Party, specifically on the subject of tariffs. But the time now, 23 minutes past 7, and it remains challenging, we are told, to sell new cars this year. We are told that by the online marketplace Auto Trader this morning, and Will is back with more.
Yeah, that's right, Justin. Auto Trader, listed on the FTSE 100 of our biggest stock market listed companies, just released their financial results for the first half of the year, and within those, warned they'd seen a 10% decrease in the number of vehicles sold through the site over that period. Nathan Coe is the Auto Trader Group's chief executive. Nathan, morning.
Good morning, Will.
Any sense for the reasons behind that decrease?
Yeah, there's a slight nuance in the data, just to be clear. Overall, on our site, we've seen probably around 5% more cars sold through Auto Trader. But when it comes to new cars, and specifically new cars sold to people like you and I through car retailers, that number has fallen 10%. And that is a continuation of some challenges that we've seen. Really, there's very few tax incentives or government incentives to encourage and help make those EVs more affordable for consumers like you and I. So we've seen very strong growth in corporates and fleets buying cars, which has meant overall our new car market is actually one of the strongest growing in Europe and indeed faster than the US and China. But when you look at those people buying, ordinary people buying ordinary new cars through ordinary channels like retailers, that number is down. And it is down to the fact that manufacturers have restrictions around the number of vehicles that they need to sell that are electric, and those electric vehicles are expensive and not everyone can afford those, particularly at this time.
Right. So the companies get aid, but individuals don't. And you think that should change?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think at the moment there are tax benefits that have persisted and been continued in the budget. And thank goodness for that, because we still want people to be able to access cars. But at the moment, those incentives are limited to those corporate channels. So things like salary sacrifice and for corporate fleets, whereas you and I cannot access that as just a private buyer through a retailer.
The issue of car financing, historical cases, been a big issue, obviously, for the sector, hasn't it? BMW and Honda, among those, saying they won't sell during car financing. I know that's obviously not necessarily how you work, but does it have an impact on the market going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have a direct impact on us, but it very much has an impact on the market. I mean, around 90% or 85% of new cars are bought on finance, and probably around 40% of used cars, people use finance to buy them. So finance is absolutely critical to making car ownership affordable for people in the UK. So I think there are some concerns. I think the reality is the industry is getting through that, and it is about really what regulators and courts are looking for is transparency around commission payments and the like.
Nathan Coe, Chief Exec at Auto Trader, thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you. 26 minutes past seven. A day on from Kamala Harris's defeat, the knives are out for Joe Biden. He shouldn't have run, said Jim Manley, a top aide to congressional Democrats. This is no time to pull punches or be concerned about anyone's feelings. He and his staff have done enormous amounts of damage to the country, he said. As for her, well, the party is split, and those who see Kamala Harris as their champion are still very much loyal to her.
I thank you all. May God bless you. And may God bless
you. We've come to Howard University, not far from the centre of Washington, D.C., the historically black university, which was one of the intellectual powerhouses of the civil rights movement, and which numbers among its former students Kamala Harris, the vice president. They so hoped she would be president as well. And the mood on election night here was ecstatic.
I'm feeling so patriotic on this night. I cannot wait for Kamala Harris to be president. So I just feel really good to be here, and I cannot wait to be a part of history.
How will you feel if she doesn't win?
I don't think that's an option at this point. I feel like she's going to win. She's going to pull through.
And then the votes were counted, and the mood changed, and the mood is very different. I've been asking people who's to blame and what should happen next.
I don't think anything went wrong from the Harris campaign. I think she did everything she was supposed to do. She couldn't do anything else. I think it's just a sign of the America we live in, that we've always lived in, and the truth is now just slapping us in the face.
And when you say the truth being what?
You know what the truth is. We all know what the truth is. So
come on, tell me.
No, you know, sexism and racism. You can never take away, this moment doesn't take away what one woman from Oakland, California accomplished. She was the vice president of the United States, period.
Guys, we're from the BBC. Have you got just a second? We're asking people what, in their view, went wrong with the campaign, if anything. Where did she go wrong? Where did the party go wrong?
I don't think she did anything wrong. I think America just doesn't like black women. That's really long and short of it.
I feel like it's very disappointing. I feel like there was a lot of optimism at the beginning, and then seeing that she was behind from the jump and never really caught up, I think that was kind of sad to see. But I feel like when she runs again and she has the same amount of time and has more time to actually get her campaign going, I think she has a better result.
That's interesting. You think she should run again in 4 years' time?
Of course. Yeah, I think so.
A simple question, I suppose. What went wrong?
We were confident in the ground game because Democrats have to do that. It's a necessity to organize underrepresented communities, working class people. At least that's who we thought our base was. Turns out we were wrong. We missed the mark. I think there's a need to do a lot of soul searching about who our base is, how we speak to our base, reconnect with our working class roots, and ask ourselves why are people who are making under a certain income threshold turning to him. Is it because they're anti-establishment more than they are pro-Trump? Is it because we've left them? The party is now more elitist and college-educated and aligned with corporate donors.
How do you deal with that? What do you do now?
I don't think the wage should be on Kamala Harris. I think this is a multi-decade problem that the party has. We've seen it with insurgent candidates like Bernie Sanders trying to buck up against the corporate class and the establishment wing of the party that is too connected to their donors. What do we do now? I think we have to take a step back. You know, it wasn't enough, in my opinion. Trump capitalized on that.
The views of people at Howard University as Kamala Harris was giving her concession speech. We'll have more on what the Democrats should or should not do after 8:30. But at 7:30, it is time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. Excited to hear from Jimmy Anderson on this programme in the next 20 minutes or so. And we start with cricket this morning because the England one-day interim coach Marcus Trescothick has asked for patience after his side fell to a series defeat against the West Indies overnight. They lost by 8 wickets with more than 7 overs to spare in the deciding ODI. Well, shortly after the match in Barbados, I spoke to Marcus Trescothick and got his reaction to the series defeat.
Yeah, we're obviously very disappointed to lose the game today and to lose the series. You know, it was very tough for us from the start. We lost the toss, lost early wickets. It made it quite challenging to get a total on the board. But I was really pleased with how the guys sort of bounced back throughout our batting innings to get a score on the board that we felt was something we might be able to defend. But as it proves here in Barbados, the toss is vitally important, and the pitch and the outfield makes it tricky because the ball gets wet and the pitch gets better. But, you know, you kind of know that at the toss of the coin, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. You did lose the toss in this decider, and as soon as that happened, you were fearful, were you, that the changing conditions could really benefit the side batting second?
Yeah, well, it big part in changing of the pitch, really. And you kind of know that when you're playing in this part of the world, especially here in Barbados. We know if you look at the stats of games played and tosses won, and so it does make a big difference. But, you know, it's just an unfortunate part of the game that we didn't go our way.
So a bruising defeat today, Marcus, undoubtedly. But do you take some solace from the fact that England are missing several first-choice players?
Yeah, sure. Look, we've come over here knowing that we've got a team that haven't got a great deal of experience, but we look at the opportunity to try and get a few games into them so that we can see these guys who potentially may impact the team going forward. And we've got a big series in India and then the Champions Trophy in sort of January, February, March. We've given debutants to a few guys already. There may be some more going into the T20s, but it's good that you can see them playing under pressure and playing in a good series against a good West Indian team.
And a quick turnaround now, you have to park this series defeat, I guess, pretty quickly and reset for a five-match T20 series which starts on Saturday. Are you confident England can be competitive in that?
Sure, yeah. I'm excited to play in the T20 series. Oh, hopefully Geoff Butler's going to continue his fitness going forward and he'll be okay for Saturday. And then just looks nice. It's a good, exciting time, isn't it? You're playing a couple of games in Barbados, and then three games in St. Lucia where, you know, we know it's going to be challenging, but really exciting because we've had some good results in various games. And again, we'll get to see the younger guys with a bit more experience under their belt and we'll hopefully challenge against a good West Indian team.
That is the England One Day interim coach, Marcus Trescothick, speaking to me a little earlier. Next to football, and a quick word on last night's Champions League action.
That's absolutely ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy from Mings. Absolutely crazy. What is he thinking?
The referee confirms that Club Bruges are going to get a penalty in the most ridiculous of circumstances.
Yes, farcical scenes in Belgium saw Aston Villa defender Tyrone Mings deliberately pick up the ball in the box after mistakenly thinking the game had been stopped. It hadn't, and a penalty was awarded to Villa's opponents Club Bruges, which they scored, and Villa lost 1-0. Meanwhile, in Italy, Arsenal also lost 1-0 to Inter Milan. And I'll just leave you with some sporting reaction to this week's US election. The result yesterday means Donald Trump will be the US president when the country hosts the next two biggest global sporting events, the Men's Football World Cup in 2026. And the Los Angeles Olympics in 2028. There are also those, like Rory McIlroy, who hope the new president-elect will be able to end the ongoing impasse between golf's PGA Tour and the Saudi Arabia-funded breakaway LIV circuit.
He might be able to. I mean, he's got Elon Musk, who I think is the smartest man in the world beside him, so he might be able to do something if we can get Musk involved too. But yeah, I think from the outside looking in, it's probably a little less complicated than it actually is. But Trump has a great relationship with Saudi Arabia. He's got a great relationship with golf. He's a lover of golf, so maybe. Who knows? But as the president of the United States again, he's probably got bigger things to focus on than golf.
That's Rory McIlroy. Trump, Amol, had previously said that he could end golf's civil war in, quote, under 15 minutes, which, considering it's been going on for 2 years, would be pretty impressive.
Well, Elon Musk's always looking for work, so,
exactly.
So he could hire him to do it. As you mentioned there, Mike, we've got Jimmy Anderson coming up in about 15 minutes live in the studio. But also, if you can't get enough of Justin and our top team in the US, here is how, where and why to get into Americast.
Follow the outcome of the US election with Americast.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States heads in its next direction.
Navigate your way through the US election.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Why not? The weather, largely cloudy and dry today, and tonight, clearer skies in northern Scotland.
Why not, indeed? You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. and Amol Rajan in London. The time is 24 minutes to 8. And now a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump is preparing to appoint members of his cabinet less than 24 hours after his victory in the race for the White House. His campaign team has said the president-elect will select his lineup in the days and weeks ahead. During his campaign, Mr. Trump said he'd invite his billionaire backer Elon Musk to join his administration, tackling what he described as government waste. Mr. Trump is said to be looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power after he beat Kamala Harris yesterday. He'll take office in January. Ms. Harris conceded the election to Mr. Trump last night in a speech on the steps of Howard University in Washington, D.C., where she'd been a student. President Biden hailed her as a public servant full of integrity, courage and character. Sir Keir Starmer has called Donald Trump to congratulate him on his victory. Mr. Trump's win and the impact it'll have on the Ukraine war will be discussed at a summit of European leaders in Hungary. The Prime Minister is among those joining the meeting in Budapest. Sir Keir will also sign agreements to help intercept people smuggling gangs in the Western Balkans as part of government efforts to cut small boat crossings. The deals will involve greater intelligence sharing and cooperation with Serbia, North Macedonia and Kosovo. Germany's three-party coalition has collapsed after ministers from the Free Democrats quit the government. Their exit comes after the Chancellor Olaf Scholz sacked his finance minister, the leader of the Free Democrats, Christian Lindner. They fell out over economic policy. And the Conservative politician Sir John Knott, who was the Defence Secretary at the time of the Falklands War, has died. He was 92. Sir John was criticised for failing to foresee the possible capture of the Falklands by Argentina and offered to resign. But the then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher kept him on, and he had a key role in her war cabinet when the UK recaptured the islands in 1982.
Thank you. 22 minutes to 8 is the time. Almost nothing in the Kamala Harris election game plan actually worked. She lost ground with a wide range of voters, and nowhere was the failure more obvious than in the state of Georgia, which Biden won in 2020 and she lost. Our correspondent John Sudworth has been in Georgia, hearing about why Donald Trump has been able to pick up so many votes from those once considered to be core Democratic supporters.
Even without the rain, a gloom hangs over Sparta. It's the kind of place Donald Trump might have in mind when he speaks darkly of American decline, although Sparta's been struggling for decades. Well, over half of the shops on the high street here are boarded up. Katie Webster is trying to change things.
We are a coffee shop and we also sell pastries and some savory items.
Behind the counter at the new coffee and craft shop, she's not convinced by Mr. Trump's promises of economic renewal.
I'm a little scared, to be honest. It disheartens me that so many Americans chose someone who, by any measure, does not seem to be a very good human being.
In Georgia, however, the bedrock of Democratic Party support is not white voters like Katie, but black voters. And in Sparta, more than two-thirds of registered voters are black, helping Kamala Harris outperform Donald Trump here with more than 67% of the vote.
That's from BBC News in England.
Lord have mercy. Good God.
But Ms. Harris has not done quite as well as Joe Biden did in 2020. Exit polls suggest Mr. Trump has been winning over more black voters, not in huge numbers, but enough to make a difference and helping him to win the state as a whole.
There's a kind of nice coincidence in that first name, Donald.
Mm-hmm.
Did you vote for your namesake?
Yeah.
You voted for Mr. Trump?
Yeah. I don't know. I believe he's going to do a good job.
71-year-old Donald Curry was swayed by the former president's messages on immigration.
They come in here, they get the money, they send it back to their hometown. If the American people wake up and stop taking care of other countries, we need to take care of us. And too much worry about the other country.
So his messages about tougher enforcement at the border, deporting immigrants, that's something you support?
Yeah, I feel like they need to be over there.
Send them home?
And send them home.
I'm a Baptist pastor. I just preach the Bible, whatever's in the Bible. We just try to get the word out for Jesus.
In Georgia, with its painful history of slavery and segregation, questions of race are never far from the surface.
Kind of generally in the South, you hear that the most segregated day of the week is Sunday.
Brian Hill is the pastor of Sparta's Baptist Church, an overwhelmingly white congregation.
Can I ask if you voted, and if so, how?
I did vote. I voted for Trump. I don't really care for Trump. I felt like, you know, I'm not voting for the pastor of the country. I'm voting for the president.
Later, outside Sparta's supermarket, I bump into Katie from the coffee shop again. She has something to add.
People in this county voted for Trump because they're racist. I just need you to know that. Don't want a woman president, and they're racist.
And yet an argument can be made that the Democrats' dismissal of their opponents in such terms and their inability to take seriously Donald Trump's appeal among voters they've long taken for granted is part of the reason they lost.
When you believe in God, there are some things that were being promoted that I just couldn't agree with. The abortion, the transgender thing, it's just not right.
Vanessa Fluellen works in law enforcement in Sparta at the local 911 hotline.
You're a black woman? This was a chance to vote for somebody who would have been America's first female black president. Did that not excite you?
Well, who said she was black?
To find black voters like Vanessa questioning Kamala Harris's race, just as Donald Trump has done, may seem extraordinary. But for Democrats, rather than repeated surprise at his success, understanding why he's making inroads in communities like this one may be the first step in fighting back.
That was John Sudworth in the state of Georgia. And that's the coalition of voters which Donald Trump managed to build up. There is also, of course, a coalition of conservative thinking that comes now to power in Washington. And it's not necessarily a stable one. Emily Jasinski is Washington, D.C.'s correspondent for the news website Unheard, who understands and is part of the right on American politics, having edited The Federalist, an influential site among conservatives. She's been telling me how an income administration is more complex than the impression some people have of a Republican Party completely captured by one man.
This is really the fundamental misunderstanding of how Donald Trump is able to succeed electorally. I think of his base, and some polling bears this out, as being about 30% a hardcore MAGA partisan group. So these are the people who go to rallies and buy the merchandise. But a lot of other Republican voters, dare I say the majority of Republican voters, are merely kind of putting up with Donald Trump because they find the left to be more threatening to them. They see the left, and immigration is a really good place to examine this phenomenon. They say, you know, if a stand-up comedian at a Trump rally says something I find offensive or distasteful about Puerto Rico or Hispanics, what I am still more offended by, I can be offended by both. I can not like that. I can be offended by it. I can just sort of tolerate it because I am more offended by millions of people coming across the border in the span of just a couple of years or a few years under the Biden presidency. So that's the first part of it. And the second part is that Donald Trump now brings, after nearly a decade in Republican politics, a more formal infrastructure to Washington with him. People who have been waiting in the wings. They were hoping for a Donald Trump or a Ron DeSantis, somebody who is not as squeamish about really going to work for it, what they see as a transformative agenda, like gutting the federal bureaucracy, going hard on immigration. They have been waiting in the wings, developing policies, and they're now ready to put some of this stuff actually into practice. They are. They're excited. If you've talked to them today, they're excited.
We tend to think of the American right as being libertarian in the sense that it's a small government right. But of course, so much of the Trump coalition is actually quite a big government right. And even more than that, what's really interesting, Emily, is this idea of the extent to which the government should or should not be involved in people's lives. And one of the things I'm thinking about is one proposal, for instance, to ban pornography, which, I mean, just doesn't kind of tally, I suppose, in a sense, with what you think of Donald Trump and his supporters.
This is such a big tension. And in terms of baggage that Republicans are coming in with, look at somebody like Elon Musk. Look at somebody like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Elon Musk has a very libertarian set of sensibilities. A lot of libertarians will scoff at that because he also, you know, is into an industrial policy for electric vehicles and for space technology and all of that. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. also thinks the government is wildly over-involved in people's lives in certain decisions like censorship. But when it comes to actually regulating food, for example, he and Tucker Carlson and other new thinkers in the space on the right desperately are demanding more regulation from the United States government. They say the lack of regulation is from corporate corruption, not the other way around. And so he's coming in with this misfit coalition that helped him get across the finish line on election night, that when you actually have to go into government and marry some of these tensions and square these circles, it is really hard to envision how that gets done. Again, Republicans here are feeling very good about their ability to do it, but they may be overly optimistic about how that looks, and that could be good good news for Democrats who feel, you know, there's something ominous about Republicans coming in with these plans, because if they're feasible is a different question.
Emily Jasinski, thank you so much for talking to us.
14 minutes to 8, climate scientists say that 2024 is almost certain to be the warmest year on record and the first calendar year where the Earth is more than 1.5 degrees hotter than it was pre the Industrial Revolution. Professor Emily Shuckburgh is the director of Cambridge Zero, the University of Cambridge's major climate change initiative, and joins us now. Professor Shuckburgh, good morning.
Good morning.
Look, obviously no particular threshold, 1.5 or 2 degrees is some sort of magic number, but what begins to happen when you reach the sort of threshold that we have just passed?
Well, in a way, we're starting to see what begins to happen already with the extreme floods that we saw just over the last few days, the wildfires we saw over the summer. As you increase the warming, every increment of a degree, you increase the risk of those sorts of extreme weather events affecting communities around the world.
And yet,
but you also risk passing tipping points in the climate system, and the sorts of things we're concerned about there are the integrity of the vast ice sheets covering Greenland and West Antarctica, or the overturning circulation of the ocean itself. So it really does matter. You're right. There's no magic number. There's no magic threshold, but it is nevertheless concerning that temperatures do look like they're going to exceed 1.5 degrees.
And hugely consequential, as you say, if you look at events in Valencia, for example. Mm-hmm. But yet you do work in Cambridge, which gives you some grounds for optimism. For instance, if you look at the innovation and new technologies, what are you seeing that gives you reasons to be hopeful?
Yeah, I do actually, and you know, funnily enough, you know, we've just had an item about the elections in the United States, and obviously a lot of people are concerned about that in terms of what the implications that might be for climate. But I think that in terms of accelerated innovation, I'm sitting in the university in Cambridge. There's all sorts of incredibly exciting, what Donald Trump might call beautiful, new technologies that are coming out here, whether that's super fast charging batteries for electric vehicles, or artificial leaves to develop synthetic fuels, or AI enabled systems, or closing the loop on manufacturing processes to slash waste.
Yeah.
We're working with innovative startups, we're working with businesses. It's really quite exciting. But we're also looking to ensure that solutions actually work on the ground. And that means really radical collaborations with communities. So one project that I lead is looking at how we can adjust the way we manage land for the benefit of climate and nature, but crucially also for the benefit of rural economies and the people who live and work in those landscapes. So there's a project that we're undertaking in the Fenlands of East Anglia, where we're working really closely with an amazing farmer-led coalition called Fenland Soil, with local conservation groups and others, okay, to look at what new solutions we might be able to generate.
Yeah. We'll look into that one in particular. Professor Shuckburgh, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It is just coming up to 10 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Regin Brooke.
Good morning. Years ago, I had a job selling butterflies in glass cases in America. I travelled to 32 states, cold selling to gift shops from the trunk of a Chevrolet. It was the 80s, and the notion of the American dream still had credence. Its exact definition was elusive, but it had something to do with freedom, opportunity, and every American having the chance of attaining a better life. The scale and beauty of America and the energy of its people made me a believer. That is, until I drove deep down into the southern states and found those living well beyond the dream's reach. Waking up yesterday from the fever dream of the American election to the reality of Donald Trump's victory speech, I noticed the signage behind the podium said, "Dream big again." It appeared to be an invitation to look back to a time when an American could dream big and to speak to the people for whom the prospect of a better life had long been out of reach. He even talked of a golden age being ushered in and the healing of wounds. It was all vaguely biblical. There is clearly a yawning gap between the American dream and the reality of American living, and Trump has skillfully harnessed this as the gap between rich and poor has widened and the road to opportunity narrowed. That dream has become fitful and more troubling. If there is such a thing as an American dream, let us hope that disaffection and rancor doesn't warp and diminish it into something meaner and less inclusive. There was once a Babylonian king called Nebuchadnezzar who had a troubling dream, A dream so unnerving, he demanded his wise men not only interpret the dream, but tell him what it was. Reasonably, they asked him to describe the dream first, so that they might interpret it. He flew into a rage and threatened to execute them. Then a young Jewish exile called Daniel stepped forward. He asked God to reveal the dream to him and to give him the interpretation. The incredible thing is that Daniel not only told the king his dream, he gave an interpretation that would have been deeply alarming for any ruler to hear, describing a shattering end to Nebuchadnezzar's golden reign. God deposes rulers and sets up others, said Daniel, and he would establish a kingdom that would outlive them all, a kingdom better than any dreamt by people. In this moment, Daniel gives us a timely perspective on who is really running things. It's the perspective of a God whose kingdom reach is not limited to the whims of a particular ruler or a particular group or political affiliation, but extends to all people, whatever their class, race, gender, or nation.
That was Thought for the Day with Ridian Brooke. The time now is 8:08. It's not often that a guest comes into the Today studio who is indisputably the best that there has ever been at what they do. But the thing about cricket is it is a numbers game and the numbers don't lie. 704 wickets, that's 100 more than the next fast bowler, at an average of, remember?
No, I've no idea.
Come on. Of course you know, 26.4.
Honestly, no idea.
26.45 in a 21-year career with 188 test matches. It was long before the end of that career this summer that Jimmy Anderson was commonly described not just as England's best bowler, but as the best current bowler, but as the greatest of them all. And he's come into the studio because he's written an autobiography. It's called Finding the Edge, and it's out today. Jimmy, welcome to Today.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. So you've got this autobiography out. It's called Finding the Edge. It's written with your mate Felix White, who's in the band The Maccabees. You co-host his podcast, Tailenders, with him and Greg James. Let's begin at the end of your career, because there's a very powerful section in the book where you describe being told to retire, and you really didn't like it. And you were invited into a room at the Dakota Hotel Bar in Manchester with Captain Ben Stokes, head coach Brendan McCullum, and ECB boss Rob Key. And you write, "I feel like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas." Why?
Yeah. Well, I think just that kind of in a dark bar in a hotel, the three of them sort of just staring at me and talking at me and feeling like, yeah, it was just like I was up against the wall and being told what to do, and being like, not let go, but sort of saying we don't sort of need you anymore. It's kind of, yeah, just quite a lot to process at the time. But I think looking back, I think everyone says, every sports person says that you, when you're talking about retirement, you wake up one day and you'll know, or there'll be a moment in your career where you think, right, I'm slowing down, or I'm not as good as I was, so this is it. And I never had that. So maybe, you know, also mentioned in the book, maybe I did need that sort of arm on the shoulder, hand on the shoulder.
You
to
needed
say,
someone else to make the
maybe,
decision.
Yeah. Boy, maybe.
I was in touch with Felix yesterday, and he felt that one of the key things about you, which a lot of people don't know or have missed, and it is in the book, is that you used to bunk school because you were picked on at school, and you'd walk to the edge of Burnley and you'd turn around and look at Burnley and almost sort of dream of escape. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting doing that walk again, because I mean, I didn't do it loads, but I did used to sort of walk. It was like, it was about 3 hours, I reckon, up to this point of Burnley, right on the edge, just as you're going out of the town. And doing this walk with Felix, it was kind of amazing to you almost look back across Burnley, and obviously it sits in sort of a valley, so yeah. It's just an amazing view. And actually, yeah, look, if you look a bit deeper into it, maybe I was trying to escape or find something else on sort of outside of the town.
Well, you certainly did that. you met with some success. I mentioned the word talent earlier. One of the things you often ask, because you have got more wickets than anyone else who's done what you do, you've been better at your job than anyone else who picked up a ball. If you want to be the best there's been at something in sport, how much of it's natural talent and how much of it is hard work?
I think some of it's natural talent. For example, my fitness, I mean, being able to stay fit and do a job which does take its toll on the body, like bowling is, it's a weird thing to do. Like, it's a strange action. You're putting pressures on different parts of your body that you wouldn't do in any other walk of life. So it's, I feel lucky that I was born with a body that can cope with that. Obviously there's lots of hard work that goes into it as well.
And sacrifice, often paid by your family.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly in cricket, when you're touring a lot, some of the tours can be up to 3 months, maybe a little bit longer. Even when you're playing in England, you're still touring the country and in hotels most of the time. So you do miss a lot. Like my kids growing up, you miss birthdays, you miss first days at school and things like that. And it can be tough, I guess. But also you have to realise that this is a really special thing that you're doing. Not a lot of people get to play for or play cricket professionally or play sport professionally, certainly not play for England. So to be able to do it for the amount of time I've done, I feel really fortunate.
And yet here you are, 42, still fit, and the news is out this week that you've just registered to play in the Indian Premier League or to go into the auction.
Yes.
So you're clearly not too keen on that retirement. Why have you done that?
It's a great question. I think there's still definitely something in me that thinks I can still play. I've never done the IPL, I've never experienced it, so I think for a number of reasons I feel like I've got more to give as a player, and I also want to, I've done a little bit of coaching since I finished in the summer. I've been around the England team doing a bit of sort of mentoring or whatever you like to call it. So I just think opening my eyes to something like that and experiencing it sort of might help me grow my knowledge of the game and help further down the line.
Begs the question, though, if it goes well, could you play Test cricket again?
I think that door's been shut, to be honest.
Possibly by other people, exactly. Jimmy Anderson, it's good to see you. Thank you very much for coming in. The book's called Finding the Edge, the autobiography, and it's out today.
Couple of minutes to eight. Next week on Radio 4, Kirsty Young invites another guest to reflect on one pressing question.
What advice would you give your younger self? That's the question I pose each week.
I think the worst thing would have been to have given me at that point more information.
It's all ephemera. None of it is real. Guests, including Minnie Driver, Gloria Steinem, and Gabor Maté, are available now on BBC Sounds.
I've contributed something that's of value and will continue to be of value.
And the series concludes with the writer Malcolm Gladwell.
If you want to understand who I am, you really shouldn't talk to me.
Young Again with me, Kirsty Young, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Tuesday morning at 9.
And now for the weather with Simon King.
Well, thanks so much indeed. It's a pretty mild start for the day, especially across Scotland and Northern Ireland, where temperatures are way above the average for the time of year at the moment. It's another cloudy start for most of us. And for England and Wales, we've got a bit of drizzle towards western areas, some mist and some fog patches, which should tend to lift up and clear away. It'll stay pretty overcast for most of us, but with a bit of a stronger breeze towards western areas of Wales and southwest England, we may well see the cloud breaking up a touch to give some sunnier skies. Maximum temperatures, 11 to 16. Degrees across Scotland and Northern Ireland. Again, pretty cloudy this morning for most, except the northeast of Scotland, where you'll have the best of the sunshine today. Temperatures here 15 to 18 Celsius. Elsewhere across Scotland, Northern Ireland, it remains fairly cloudy with temperatures about 11 to 15 degrees.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday the 7th of November. The headlines this morning: President-elect Trump is preparing to choose members of his top team after being invited by Joe Biden to the White House to ensure there's a smooth transition of power. Kamala Harris has admitted defeat but urged her supporters not to concede the fight that fueled her campaign. At 10 past 8, what might another Trump administration do? What might it do, including the idea of it imposing trade tariffs? What would that mean for US relations with the UK?
My task is to maintain a balance between all three services and most expert opinion, setting aside those who want to drive divisions between the services, is of the opinion that we've probably got the balance about right.
But why should the public on this issue, as regards the future of the Royal Navy, believe you, a transient here today and if I may say so, gone tomorrow politicians.
That certainly wasn't the right clip, was it, Amol? You're going to have to explain that. I think we'll
that was
explain
a clip
someone else.
Of the former Defence Secretary John Nott, who died yesterday and who had a famous interview with Robin Day, which we shall hear later in the programme, quite possibly. That wasn't a clip about President Donald Trump. But anyway, it is 8:01, and coming up in the next hour as well, the head of the National Crime Agency tells us how he plans to bring down the numbers of small boat crossings.
So much depends on what is happening in the rest of the world, so it's very hard to commit to anything particular. What we do know is that if we weren't making the efforts that we are, and with the successes that we are having, the figures would be much larger.
The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team has said that the US president-elect is preparing to select his cabinet less than 24 hours after his dramatic political comeback. Mr. Trump is said to be looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power after he beat Kamala Harris yesterday. Joe Biden is due to make a televised address this afternoon. Our correspondent Neda Tofik reports from Florida, where Mr. Trump's team is based.
Donald Trump's transition team says that in the coming days, he will be selecting the best people to join his administration to make the lives of Americans affordable, safe, and secure. A visit to the White House is expected to take place in the near future after Joe Biden called to congratulate the president-elect on his victory and extended an invitation to the Oval Office to ensure a smooth transition. It's a courtesy Donald Trump did not afford Mr. Biden 4 years ago when he lost the election. A tone of civility between political rivals is holding for now, with Mr. Trump's spokesperson saying that he appreciated Joe Biden's call. Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, who has kept a low profile in recent years, also released a statement. She said the new administration would safeguard the heart of the republic, freedom. And she said she anticipated citizens would rise above ideology for the sake of individual liberty, economic prosperity, and security.
Kamala Harris conceded the election to Mr. Trump yesterday evening in a speech on the steps of Howard University in Washington, where she'd been a student. She urged her Democrat supporters to keep fighting for what they believed in.
It is okay to feel sad and disappointed, but please know it's going to be okay. On the campaign, I would often say, when we fight, we win. But here's the thing. Sometimes the fight takes a while. That doesn't mean we won't win. The important thing is don't ever give up.
Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer has offered his hearty congratulations to Donald Trump on his victory during a telephone call. The Prime Minister's spokesperson said the two men also agreed that the relationship between the UK and the US was incredibly strong and would continue to thrive. Sir Keir will be among European leaders who will discuss the impact of Donald Trump's victory on Ukraine at a summit in Hungary. Our Europe editor Katja Adler is at the meeting in Budapest.
Donald Trump will be the main focus of today's meeting. What his return to the White House might mean in terms of trade tariffs, China policy, European security, and perhaps most urgently, the future of Ukraine. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is in Budapest. He remarked that U.S. leadership is vital for a just peace after speaking to Donald Trump yesterday. But the fear here is the new U.S. administration will slow, if not stop, the flow of American military aid to Kyiv. Donald Trump has boasted in the past he could end the war with Russia in a day. What isn't clear is whether he wants Ukraine to win.
Germany's three-party coalition has collapsed after ministers from the Free Democrats quit the government. Their exit follows a decision by the Chancellor Olaf Scholz to sack his finance minister Christian Lindner, the Free Democrat leader. Mr. Scholz announced a vote of confidence would be held in January, which could lead to early elections. Damian McGuinness reports from Berlin.
For months, the arguments have been growing louder within the German government, mainly over how to balance the budget. Chancellor Scholz wants to boost spending with new debt. The finance minister opposed this and wanted to cut taxes too. This unusual coalition of centre-left Social Democrats, Greens and free market liberals was always going to be tricky. When it formed 3 years ago, there was enough money to paper over the cracks. But then Russia invaded Ukraine, energy prices shot up, and Germany had to boost spending on defence. The prospect of a Trump presidency is now adding to the sense of urgency that Germany needs a strong and united government to kickstart the economy.
There have been several loud explosions in southern Beirut overnight, an hour after the Israeli army told residents in four districts of the Lebanese capital to leave. Israel said it hit Hezbollah command centres and weapons stores. Earlier, Lebanon's health ministry said at least 40 people had been killed yesterday during Israeli bombing in the east of the country. The Lebanese culture minister, Mohamed Mottada, said the Ottoman-era Manshir building in Baalbek city had been severely damaged. Metropolitan Police have submitted a file of evidence to prosecutors to consider bringing charges against the former Radio 1 presenter Tim Westwood. The 66-year-old has been accused of non-recent sexual abuse, which he has previously denied. Here's our correspondent Chichi Azundo.
The criminal inquiries against Tim Westwood began after a joint investigation by BBC News and The Guardian in 2022 heard from 18 women who accused him of predatory and unwanted sexual behaviour and touching. Tim Westwood has always denied those allegations, but detectives have confirmed they're still investigating a number of reports relating to allegations of non-recent sexual offences in London between 1982 and 2016. Officers say the investigation is complex and sensitive and have now passed on a file of evidence to the Crown Prosecution Service to consider whether he should be charged.
The Bank of England will announce its latest interest rate decision at midday, with economists widely expecting a second cut this year, which would take the base rate under 5%. The rate of inflation is now below the bank's target of 2%, but investors will be watching the bank's latest quarterly economic forecast, also being released today, for clues about the impact of last week's budget on future rate cuts. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
A cut to 4.75% will show renewed confidence that the UK has put behind it years of inflationary shocks. In response to the big tax spend and borrowing measures in the budget, traders have pushed up the cost of government borrowing. This is essentially a market bet that the bank will cut rates a little less than previously expected because of extra inflationary pressures. Rises to the national living wage and employers' national insurance could affect the bank's forecasts for inflation and so slow the path of mortgage rate cuts. In the US, its central bank, the Federal Reserve, is also expected to cut rates tonight.
A 600-year-old Renaissance masterpiece will go on public display for the first time after the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford raised millions of pounds to buy it. Fra Angelico's Crucifixion had been at risk of being taken out of the country. Here's our culture reporter, Guy Lambert.
Painted on a gold panel in luminous colours, Fra Angelico's earliest surviving work depicts Christ on the cross, with the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene and St John the Evangelist at his feet. The painting had been in the UK for about two centuries, but it was sold to an overseas buyer in July. The government placed a temporary bar on the painting's export, giving the Ashmolean enough time to raise almost £4.5 million to acquire the masterpiece, thanks to more than 50 major donors and a public appeal. It will now go on display for the first time. The director of the museum, Dr. Zar Sturgis, said he was thrilled that millions of visitors will now be able to enjoy this beautiful, moving and important work.
The Conservative politician Sir John Knott, who was Defence Secretary at the time of the Falklands invasion, has died. He was 92. Sir John played a key role in Lady Thatcher's war cabinet. Will Vernon looks back on his life.
When Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands in 1982, Sir John Knott offered his resignation to the Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher. But she turned it down, despite accusations that Sir John failed to anticipate the capture of the islands. In fact, his shortcomings were rather more serious than that. He later admitted that he wasn't even sure where the Falklands were and had to consult a globe in his office at the Ministry of Defence. After the conflict was over, he retired from politics and received his knighthood. But Sir John will also be remembered for storming out of a live interview with the BBC presenter Sir Robin Day on Newsnight in 1982.
Why should the public on this issue, as regards the future of the Royal Navy, believe you, a transient, here today and if I may say so, gone tomorrow politician, rather than a senior officer of many years.
I'm fed up with this interview, really. It's a ridiculous ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Knott.
The former Defence Secretary, it seems, didn't hold a grudge against Sir Robin for very long, as he later called his memoirs Here Today, Gone Tomorrow, in tribute to his TV tantrum.
That report was from Will Vernon.
Thank you. It brings us to 11 minutes past eight. Personnel, they say here in Washington, is policy. In other words, the choices of the men and women picked for the top jobs in the Trump administration will tell us a good deal about how Donald Trump will govern. We are some way off knowing who the top team will be, but the transition staff will soon be up and running. And in a moment, we turn to what the policy priorities Donald Trump has are and what he might actually do on tariffs, on the border, on international affairs. First, though, what of the transition? Sarah Smith, our North America editor, is at Donald Trump's Florida HQ.
We do know Donald Trump's really quite superstitious about these things, and in 2016 was refusing to talk about who would be in his government or even a transition team in case it jinxed his chances of winning the presidency. Now, everything is being approached a little bit more professionally this time round, from the way the campaign was run to some of the elements around the transition, but there's a huge number of jobs to be filled, and of course there are a huge number of people who want to get those posts. The most important thing he has to do is come up with a chief of staff, and that he will choose very carefully, not least because his last chief of staff, John Kelly, in the closing days of this campaign, came out and said that he thinks Donald Trump meets the definition of a fascist. So he'll be looking for somebody who would be considerably more loyal and on side than that. It's rumoured that Susie Wiles, who ran his campaign, that she would be a contender for the job, but there will be a lot of jostling in the Trump camp for that. The only names he's really floated himself are slightly controversial ones. Elon Musk, whom he has suggested could be in charge of a Department of Government Efficiency. He wants him to slash government spending, get rid of billions of dollars worth of spending. This idea came up when he was congratulating Elon Musk on what a brilliant job he did of sacking thousands of people when he took over Twitter. And he thought that's exactly the kind of attitude he needs to take into government with him. And Robert Kennedy Jr., who was of course running his own independent presidential campaign and then a few months ago threw his weight behind Donald Trump. He has been apparently promised some position in health. Donald Trump's talked about putting him in charge of women's health, but actually he might have a more substantial role in some kind of health administration. But there are thousands and thousands of jobs that have to be filled in this transition, not just the high-profile cabinet ministers, but all kinds of civil servants. And we know that Donald Trump has talked about culling thousands of existing civil servants to replace them with loyalists who will do what he says rather than say, oh, Mr. President, that's against the rules or that's unconstitutional. He wants people who will do his bidding. So there is a huge job of work to be done in less than 3 months to put together the Trump administration.
And on that subject of people who will do his bidding, there is an expectation, isn't there, that he will, in his terms, learn the lessons of his first administration, where quite a few of the people he appointed he later fell out with. He really does want loyalists this time.
Yeah, he wants people who will fulfill his mandate. And, you know, he has a big mandate from the electorate now, and he has some bold, radical and controversial ideas, not least of which is a really drastic shutdown on the southern border. He has talked about exiling millions of undocumented migrants who live in America. Now, maybe that's not what he will actually do. Maybe we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. But nonetheless, I mean, this is going to be something the likes of which we have never seen before, and something that probably a lot of people who have been long-time served government officials might balk at. Donald Trump is not going to stand for any of that. He wants to make sure that what he promised the electorate will get done.
That was Sarah Smith talking to me from Florida. Let us turn then to those policy ideas and to Donald Trump's approach to governing in his second term in the White House. Pete Sessions is a veteran Republican congressman from Texas. When I talked to him, we began with the Trump style this time round.
Donald Trump learned his first 4 years some things that I think had to do it again, he would do them differently. And now is that time. And I think that Donald Trump has gotten closer in his mind than, let's say, he was of the old Donald Trump. Now, you'd say, oh, no, he still is quite able to reach back and, you know, swat someone or to do the things that he wants to do. No, I think I'm talking about how he would govern, what his policies would be, what his discipline and orientation. He will have an entirely different United States Senate, someone who can very quickly debate issues and pass things, a very deliberate opportunity. I think America's in a circumstance where it needs direction and action, and I think that that's what he will be disciplined enough to do.
What will his priorities be?
They are about the border first. And I will tell you that our Border Patrol federal law enforcement officers are delighted. They were put on the defensive for 4 years, taken advantage of by drug cartels and other people. Millions of people come to this country, and they served, instead of law enforcement function, they served the function of babysitters and hospital givers and other things. So I think that it will be the border. I think it will be next criminal aliens. Look, I think there is an understanding that he now can serve, I think, without a huge distraction. Will there be a headwind? Yes. Will there be a distraction? Probably less of one.
Some big banks have already cut their growth forecasts for Britain and other countries outside the United States as a result of what they understand to be Donald Trump's policy on tariffs, that he's going to slap tariffs on goods from abroad and that will hit those countries from which those goods come. Do you think he's actually going to do it?
I don't think it will just be on all tariffs. I don't think that we want that. I don't think we need that. But I am not as big of a tariff person, and yet I do understand why he's doing what he's doing. Steel, cement, big items. So I think they'll be a little bit sharper in their enunciation of how that would work.
But if you're a Brit and you're exporting at the moment to the United States, whether it's goods or a service, should you or should you not feel concerned about what Donald Trump might do?
Well, I think that we've got an interparliamentary group of people. Certainly you've got conservatives. And I think that there is an obligation on our part and theirs, not just the trade ambassador and through your prime minister or through our president and State Department. We need to make America great again, but we need Great Britain to be great also. And I think that it's one thing if you slap tariffs off people who are taking advantage of you, as opposed to somebody who just is your friend and we're just going to do this. As a way of doing business, I don't support it. As a way of doing business to level playing fields, I don't have as much of a problem. And I think much of what we do with Great Britain is on a business venture basis. That is good for both economies, that is not harmful to the United States, and that would be part of a regular relationship that we would have with our trusted friends from Great Britain.
Congressman, what should he do about Ukraine?
Well, probably it could be said that there's a bit of, I think, movement on the president on this issue. The election's over. I don't know. We're going to find out.
I suppose in the past, though, there has been an understanding in Europe that Donald Trump, or a sense in Europe, that Donald Trump, because of the things he said, is actually quite dismissive of the idea that Russia would go any further, or that it's America's business if it does. Are you saying not only that you don't think that's the case, but that Donald Trump himself has come around to your way of thinking?
I think that he has matured some of his thinking that we don't have full visibility on yet. And that is, if he thinks he can stop a war, and I believe he's very good at conversations that let people know that America's resolve is that they will not be involved in an unlimited war. They'll be involved in a war to win. And I think that winning aspect is the one thing about Donald Trump that others misunderstood, perhaps. But he is for stability, not chaos.
Final thought about the Middle East. I mean, he has said various things about the conflict between Israel and Hamas, and indeed the wider conflict. What do you think he'll actually do? What will he enforce, if he can enforce something, in that region?
Well, in fact, I want to give the president high marks on his ability to effectively work from a position of strength. Yeah, he went and involved other key players, as you will recall, and it gave Israel great confidence and strength. It was only with the change of administration, might I say, an administration who had no problem playing footsie with the Iranians. I think he will be very interested in listening to Bibi Netanyahu. This has not been an easy road for Israel, but I think it works everybody closer to a resolve.
Do you believe, finally, that if Israel said we need to attack Iran, and if they felt that the threat from Iran was sufficient for that to be justified, that he would go along with it?
The Iranians are a dangerous lot of people, and they have been given, as you know, an incredible amount of money and leverage to help them by the Biden administration, by Barack Obama. I think that they are going to have to be very careful about what they're tangling with. We're for strength and we're for deterrence, but we're for avoiding chaos. And I think that Donald Trump is smart enough not to become engaged in a war. I mean, a war does not move America's future forward positively. It takes strength. And this is what the Iranians recognize. They recognize weakness, and they will exploit that. They see strength, and they will go home and wait another day. I think Donald Trump is not Ronald Reagan, but I think that he's learned a lot more about Ronald Reagan, and I think he buys off more of his philosophy now than he did in the past.
Congressman Pete Sessions, thank you so much for talking to us.
22 minutes past eight. What does the re-election of President Trump mean for this country and for the political project pursued by the new-ish Labour government? Well, Pat McFadden is the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster and was Labour's election campaign coordinator. And when I spoke to him a short time ago, I started by asking him why he thought Trump's campaign worked and why the one from the Democrats did not.
I've been on the receiving end of losing results and also involved in winning campaigns. And I don't want to be giving out lectures to people after they've lost an election.
No, but what's your analysis? I'm interested in your analysis.
How bad that feels. But you're right that we should always be interested and curious about elections in other countries. If I can reflect on what we did in changing the Labour Party between 2020 and 2024, we had a real focus on living standards and how people felt. And the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Originally, the Ronald Reagan question from the 1980s that Donald Trump posed in the campaign was actually one that we posed, and Rachel Reeves in particular posed during the election. And that's why, if you go to the budget last week, there were a number of measures in there directly concerned with what they would call in the United States pocketbook issues. And by that, I mean the rise in the minimum wage, no rise in income tax, freezing fuel duty, keeping the triple lock, letting carers earn more and so on. What unites all these issues is a concern with living standards and how people pay their bills month to month. And I think it's really important for parties of the centre and centre left to keep a focus on these issues because people really care about them and because we've got a duty to help people who get up in the morning, go out to work and do the right thing.
And as you say, there's a really important distinction between those living standards and real wages compared to, if you like, macroeconomic numbers around growth and job creation. But isn't it true, Mr. McFadden, that in some specific ways, the election of Donald Trump does make life a little bit harder for you? First of all, Bidenomics, which Rachel Reeves has in a sense espoused, has just lost an election. On climate change, he's not where you are. On Ukraine, he's not where you are. Isn't the truth that on a number of specific policy areas, you've just got someone in the White House now who takes a very different approach to the Labour government of this country?
Well, we could go through those things one by one. When it comes down to it, of course, we will argue for our position on any of those things that you mentioned. But I think you underestimate in putting it like that, the deep friendship between the two countries, the deep alliance of values and interests from security and defence right through to the commercial trading relationship. This is such an important alliance for the United Kingdom, for the United States, and I would argue for the world. And that's why it endures through all the different changes in government. And I'll tell you an interesting thing, which is just an accident of timing, in a way, about the election in the UK and the US, is that because they come within a few months of one another, for the next 4 years, the character of the governments in both countries are set, and therefore we can look to what I believe can be a positive and fruitful working relationship. That is totally the spirit in which we respond to this result, the spirit in which the Prime Minister phoned President-elect last night, and where we'll go on from here.
It is a bit of an issue, isn't it? I mean, the fact that Labour cabinet members have said pretty fruity, pretty rude things about Donald Trump in the past, you could sort of overcome by saying, well, you know, it was one-off and that was a different world. But if we actually went through some of the things that people in the Labour cabinet have said, it is quite the litany. To David Lammy, Foreign Secretary, said Trump is not only a woman-hating, neo-Nazi sympathising sociopath, he's also a profound threat to the international order that has been the foundation of Western progress for so long. Wes Streeting, Trump is such an odious, sad little man. Imagine being proud to have that as your president. Steve Reed, not just a clown, but a dangerous clown, he said of Donald Trump. Lisa Nandy, welcome Donald Trump, human rights nightmare. And Keir Starmer, in 2018, humanity and dignity, two words not understood by President Trump. Now, I know you could say those are different, you know, words in a different context. People move on in politics. But Donald Trump's got a long memory, and that's a lot of very strong opinions by people who are now in the Labour cabinet.
Well, if it all worked on that basis, he wouldn't have had J.D. Vance as his running mate. This is his running mate. He's now the vice president-elect. Mused a few years ago about whether Donald Trump was the new Richard Nixon or America's Hitler. His biggest business backer, Elon Musk, was advising him to walk off into the sunset a couple of years ago. The truth is, if Donald Trump didn't speak to people who'd sort of said things like that, there would be a lot of people he wouldn't be speaking to, and he wouldn't have had the running mate that he has. I know you can read these things out, but the alliance between Britain and the United States is much more important than all that. It is so deep. It's based on real common interests in defence and security. It's really serious. It's really long-standing. And I think that for the next few years, with both elections now behind us, the duty for us is to work with the new president and his new administration, and we will do that in the interests of the United Kingdom, and I would argue in the interests of the world more broadly.
I understand the general point you're making about the special relationship and about the alliance. Can I ask you about a specific, which is how would the alliance tolerate a 10 or 20% tariff on imported goods?
Well, by arguing for our interests. We are an open trading economy. You know, the trade in goods and in services around the world is really important to us. We don't want a trade war for that reason. But in all of these things, the other thing I would advise is look at what President Trump does and not just what is said in the heat of the campaign. We learned that lesson the last time that he was in office, and I think that's the best way to approach this and the most level-headed way in which to approach it.
Pat McFadden, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, thank you very much indeed for joining us again.
And that brings us to 8:30 and a red letter day for Mike and the sport.
Thank you, Justin. Yes, you wait for one decorated former England international to join you in the studio, and then two arrive in the space of 30 minutes after Jimmy Anderson was here chatting with Amol earlier. Delighted to say that we're now joined by one of England's most experienced rugby union internationals of the last 15 years.
Kerr sees the gap and he starts through Danny Kerr. He could be in. He is in. What a try from Danny Kerr. The big dive. And how big a moment is that?
Danny Kerr played over 100 times for England and won 3 Six Nations Championships before retiring from the national team earlier this year. Still plays for Harlequins, of course, where he's also won 2 Premiership titles. And he joins us in the studio now. Morning, Danny.
Morning, mate.
So much to talk to you about, but I want to start by asking you about your reflections and thoughts on the toil that you say playing rugby union has had on your and your teammates' body. A quote from you in your new book says, "I'll see a teammate laid out unconscious or barely able to walk after a game and think, how is this meant to be fun?"
Yeah, somehow it still is fun. No, I'm incredibly lucky to have had the career in rugby and in the sport that I love. And I'm incredibly proud of what I've managed to achieve. But yeah, it comes at a cost. It comes at a price. I will say, I caveat it all by, I play a different sport to these forwards. These forwards, you can see the way someone like Joe Marler or Jason Leonard walks these days. I hopefully, touch wood, I'm not going to be as bad as that. But yeah, what the boys and girls have to put their body through is incredible. But it's a barbaric sport. It's a sport full of physical intensity, contact. It's why we love it. I think that's when you boil it down. It's a sport where it's gladiatorial. We love that aspect of it. But yeah, at the end of the day, there's some sore bodies by the end of the career.
Yeah, I'm struck in the book actually that you do say that it is important, of course, for the authorities to take things like concussion and brain injuries very seriously, but also remembering at the same time that rugby is a contact sport. And you say that the main selling point is that gladiatorial nature, and that the physicality of the game shouldn't be watered down too much.
No, I agree. I do feel the game is as safe as it can be at the moment. But I caveat that again by saying rugby will never be safe. It's not a fully safe sport. It can't be because of the size of the impacts, the speed, the collisions. But I do feel at the moment that rugby is really on top of player welfare, head knocks, HIA protocols. It's in the safest way it can be at the moment.
Now, you played under four England head coaches, and it's your comments about working with the longest serving of those, Eddie Jones, that has made some headlines this week. You say in your book, everyone was terrified of him.
Yeah, look, I think what people have probably heard so far is one side of the coin. I do balance it out in the book. Eddie, I stand by the fact he's one of the best coaches I ever worked with. He saw things that no other players saw and no other coaches can see. He was a genius. We had some really tough times with Eddie. He said when he first came in, this is going to be incredibly hard. I'm going to make you the fittest team in the world. It's not going to be easy to get there. If you don't want to do it, then get out the room now. No one left, so we bought in. It was physically, emotionally incredibly tough, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. But we got incredible successes for a time in it, which I wouldn't change it. You know, he did some amazing things for English rugby. He's a brilliant coach. He did some slightly questionable things as well in our time. And yeah, hopefully if you read the book, you'll see the good, the bad and the ugly.
Yeah, particularly enjoyed the anecdote in the book of Eddie Jones dropping you for an England game via a 4-second voicemail on the phone. We'll let people enjoy that one in the book. But on a wider point about coaching, not necessarily focusing on Eddie Jones, can a coach exercise too much power? Is this rule by fear approach always that conducive to getting the best out of a team?
No, I believe in my time of what I've experienced is it can work for a certain time period, and it definitely did with Eddie. You know, you did tread on eggshells everywhere you went. If you said the wrong thing, you were there's a chance you were never to be seen again. I foolishly challenged the top at some point, and I had a 4-year hiatus out of the squad, so it took me a long time to get back. But I kind of always kept believing, I kept dreaming of getting back in that England shirt, and never gave up, which hopefully is a bit of a theme of the book. I managed to get back in, have an incredible end to my England career, and under Steve Borthwick gave me an opportunity to wear the England shirt again and make my 100th cap.
And just a very final brief word on this current England side. Another narrow defeat at the weekend, losing by 2 points to the All Blacks. Biggest challenge for them now seems to be turning these close defeats into tight wins.
That's the golden egg. It's the golden goose trying to create that, you know, those memories of just trying to win those really tight games against the best teams in the world. And they're up against a really good one again in Australia on Saturday. Can't wait for that game. And then the world champions come to Twickenham in a week's time. So there's some exciting times for this England team at the moment.
Danny Kerr, great to chat to you. Thanks so much for coming in to speak to us. Danny's book, Everything Happens for a Reason, My Life in Rugby, is released today.
Great to hear from you, Danny. It's 25 minutes to 9, and In Our Time is on at 9 o'clock. Here's Melvin Bragg with the details.
Good morning. We'll be discussing the poet George Herbert, who, according to Simone Veil, wrote the most beautiful poem in the world, unquote. He died in 1633 at the age of 40, leaving his poems on his relationship with God to be published if they offered comfort, but otherwise to be burned. Charles I read them before his execution. Congregations sing them as hymns each Sunday, and at times when Christians have been deeply divided, they could unite in their love for Herbert's poems. And he wrote in Latin too, arguably those are even better. That's George Herbert with Helen Wilcox, Victoria Mole and Simon Jenkins on Radio 4 and on BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to today.
And to the weather, largely cloudy and dry today and tonight as well. Clearer skies in northern Scotland.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in Washington, D.C. and Amol Rajan in London. It's 24 minutes to nine. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
Donald Trump's campaign team says he's preparing to choose members of his cabinet and is looking forward to meeting President Biden at the White House to discuss a smooth transition of power. During his campaign to return to the Oval Office, Mr. Trump said his plans included rounding up and deporting undocumented migrants and cutting climate rules. Downing Street says Sir Keir Starmer has offered his hearty congratulations to Donald Trump on his victory during a telephone call. The Cabinet Office Minister Pat McFadden told us that for the next 4 years, the characters of the British and American governments were set, and he looked forward to a fruitful relationship. The German government is in crisis after one of its three coalition parties quit. The move comes after the Chancellor Olaf Scholz sacked the Free Democrats leader and finance minister Christian Lindner in a dispute over trust and policy. And the Japanese carmaker Nissan has announced it's cutting 9,000 jobs worldwide and will cut global production capacity by 20% as part of cost-saving measures. Nissan has a plant in Sunderland, but it isn't known whether UK jobs are affected.
Alan, thank you very much indeed, as ever. It's 23 minutes to nine. How do you actually stop the boats? You may remember during the election campaign that Sir Keir Starmer said his experience as chief prosecutor in taking on terrorists and organised crime gangs would help defeat the smugglers who bring people across the channel. Well, at the Interpol General Assembly in Glasgow this week, the Prime Minister announced more money for this issue and also revealed new agreements with countries in the Western Balkans, particularly focusing on sharing of intelligence. One of the organisations receiving more support was a partner at the Interpol event. That's the National Crime Agency. And earlier I spoke to its boss, Graham Bigger, and I asked him the size of his current caseload.
Well, we've got 70 live investigations at the moment. That number's always changing as we bring cases to court or to conclusion. Sometimes that's in the UK. There are fewer of the smugglers who are based in the UK, more of them in Europe. So we had a case that we announced, or the French announced just earlier this week, 18 individuals convicted of people smuggling. And that was a case we'd worked really closely with Police Nationale in the French system on, and indeed the Belgians and other countries across Europe.
Absolutely. It's an international problem, and it's a very difficult problem, partly because it requires this international cooperation like you're announcing today. Just before we get into that cooperation, those deals you're doing, what are the main obstacles that you are confronting every day that get in the way of your being able to pursue your objectives?
So a lot of the obstacles that we face in investigating every crime, and people do this in a covert way, and they work very hard to stay hidden. And then with this particular crime, of course, it is happening globally, and less of the crime is taking place in the UK. So it's so crucial that we are working with our international partners. That's largely where the crime is happening, in the smuggling from source countries across Europe, the bringing in of the boats and equipment that enable that, everyone getting onto those boats in France. So a lot of the investigations have to be joined.
You mentioned the boats. A lot of our listeners will have, who don't follow this on a daily basis, who aren't involved like you are in those prosecutions, will have a general sense that the numbers of people coming over have reduced from some countries, but not from others. Why is it proving so hard, in your view, to quote a former Prime Minister, to stop the boats?
Yeah, well, this is challenging. I mean, it's a geopolitical phenomenon. There is a real demand for people to leave certain countries and to come largely north. And what's particularly hard for us is that the people themselves are not illegal. Their presence in the UK or in some countries on the way here may be illegal. And often the tools that they are using to get here are not themselves illegal, boats and engines. So being able to prove a criminal conspiracy is quite hard. It's very different from drugs, for example. If you manage to seize the drugs, that's clearly criminal.
This is obviously a top priority for the new Prime Minister. During the election campaign, he talked at great length about smashing the gangs and about his former work as Director of Public Prosecution.
solutions in trying to do that, especially when it came to terrorists. Could you just help our listeners understand what may or may not be different about the Starmer approach? What's the new thing, the new world that you're working with this new government, and what may or may not work within that approach in your view?
So the new government are talking about bringing in legislation to increase the powers available to us to investigate and prosecute these smugglers.
Will that help you?
Yeah, no, absolutely it will. We are fed into the process there. There will be consultation coming out or a bill being published, and you will see it shortly. So that will be a factor. The other thing they are doing is working incredibly hard with partners internationally. As you know, we had the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary here in Glasgow for the Interpol General Assembly opening it. The Prime Minister made a speech talking about the importance of this issue, not just to the UK, but to the world.
We've been very frank in this conversation and indeed in all our coverage about how hard this is as a problem to solve. But just so that people have got the numbers, in 2022, there were 45,755 people that crossed. In 2023, 29,437, and this year already 31,000, and we're just at the start of November. Is your view that with the changes that we've announced, can you be, if anything, closer to being confident that we will get these numbers down to something closer to zero in the next couple of years?
I think close to zero is a very hard thing to promise, and it's very difficult to have exact confidence on what happens. And so many things are changing. The 45,000 figure that you talked about, there was a large number of Albanians that came over in that year that boosted the figures. We worked really closely with Albania. Those have come down. We've seen different nationalities appear. So much depends on what is happening in the rest of the world.
You're a busy man, so you won't necessarily have had a chance to listen to the whole series, but the BBC did do a podcast called To Catch a Scorpion, in which a journalist from the BBC was able to track down the smuggler Barzan Majid. What did you make of that investigation?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was great work and great journalism. And we are doing the same thing all the time. We don't then publish it in the news. We do it in a different way, though, and we do it in a way that has a whole series of laws and legislation around it. And we can't go and intercept people in other countries without getting host nation support, as we call it, you know, agreements with those countries to run agents or sources into those countries and intercept people. So we have a slightly tighter framework around us than the BBC does. But it was good work, good journalism, and exposed some of the problems that we are facing.
Graham Bigger, head of the National Crime Agency, thank you so much for joining us.
And that brings us to 18 minutes to nine. How's the Democratic Party here in the United States going to fare in the years ahead? What does it need to do? There is, of course, going to be an inquest and much advice from foes, but also from friends. One of them, Deborah Mattison, is on the line, the Labour strategist and pollster who has advised the Harris campaign. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Were you surprised by the result?
No, I wasn't really. I've been doing some work since the summer with the Progressive Policy Institute, which is a US-based think tank. We ran polling and focus groups in the summer. And in fact, right up to speed, we're doing a sort of post-election review. And I was listening to a group of men, motor workers in Michigan last night, explaining why they'd voted as they'd voted. Look, it was a change election. 7 out of 10 of Americans said that they were unhappy with the direction that the country was in. And the winner needed to be able to be the change that they wanted to see. And Harris really struggled to do that, given the job that she had done before. So, it was tough, and I wasn't surprised.
What is interesting here, it seems to me, is that some people are suggesting there is a more profound problem, not just with the Democratic Party, actually, but with, in a sense, the whole political class. I want to play you a clip of Scott Jennings, a Republican strategist. He's a TV pundit now on CNN in the hours after it became obvious what the result was. Let's listen to him.
Well, I do think the political information complex in this country, which is fueled by the news media plus the political parties, you know, plus the other, you know, the institutions that kind of dominate and have the capacity to set our national conversations, they're totally disconnected from the people that just elected Donald Trump. You watch the news in the United States for the last week, all you would have heard about is Puerto Rico, this poll out of Iowa, which turned out to be wildly inaccurate. And I think they were trying to, some people were trying to will into existence a political reality that just didn't exist.
That was Scott Jennings talking to me earlier, and his clip on CNN really has gone viral. I mean, it's got right around the States and the world as well. Do you think there is something that he has hit on in America that matters to us as well, which is this idea that sometimes the political class and journalists and all of us talk about things that actually are completely different to what the concerns of most people are?
I absolutely do. And I think the parallel for us that makes it easy for us to understand is actually what happened in Brexit with the European referendum, where I think the political elites, if you like, talked to themselves, had a kind of world view that they felt was the view that everybody should share, and completely failed to understand where ordinary people were coming from. You know, it's confirmation bias as well. You pick up the evidence that supports the view that you already have. I mean, actually, polling and focus groups told us that that Leave were as likely to win as Remain, and so it proved to be. And yes, I think to a degree we are seeing that in the US. And I think that the Democrats have a particular problem here. It was very interesting listening to these men in Michigan last night, who really feel that the Democrats, who they had voted for in the main, they voted for Biden in the last election, but they felt that the party had moved away from people like them. They weren't actually hostile. They were just a little bit bewildered, a little bit puzzled. When we asked them who the Democrats were for, they really struggled to answer that in a very clear way. They talked variously about being for elites, which is interesting and reflects what we've just said. But they also felt that maybe the Democrats were on the side of diversity, or therefore very hard done by people, not like them, but people who were out of work and really, really struggling. They were struggling too, but they were in work and felt themselves to be relatively fortunate. So there's a sense of, certainly for the Democrats, of not having a clear, if you like, a clear audience that they're supporting, not being clear whose side they're on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, it's a conversation that we are going to, well, it's only just starting, isn't it? It's going to go on for most of the next 4 years. Deborah Mattinson, thank you very much.
Well, what's so interesting is actually what Deborah Mattinson is saying there chimes exactly with what Joe Rogan and Elon Musk said on their most recent podcast discussion about how they used to be Democrats, but have now turned to back Trump, albeit for very different reasons to those men in Michigan. We might turn back to that with 5 minutes to go on this programme. For now, let's talk about Europe. As we were hearing earlier in the programme, European leaders are gathered in Budapest for a summit to discuss cooperation at a time when the return of Donald Trump to the White House sets a raft of new foreign policy challenges for old allies. And our Europe editor, Katia Adler, is in Budapest. Morning from London, Katia. Katia, we heard this morning actually from the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, who said that there will be serious consequences for European security when Trump takes office. What might those be?
That's right. And he was unable to specify exactly what those might be, Amal. But it was a real tone change from his reaction immediately after we were hearing about Donald Trump's victory in the United States. He sounded bullish then. He said, you know, Europe no longer needs to rely on who the next president of the United States is. It holds its fate in its own hands. But that is definitely not the sense here in Budapest at this meeting of EU leaders and non-EU leaders. So Keir Starmer's here, President Zelensky of Ukraine is here as well. And although, if you like, many are putting a brave face on it and have rushed to congratulate Donald Trump, he knows full well that many of the leaders here would actually have preferred the other candidate, Kamala Harris, to become the next US president. And they're worried. They're worried about security because Europe looks to the US and to have its back over security because of an expansionist Russia and defending Ukraine. Donald Trump is no friend at all of the military alliance NATO. There are also concerns of course, over trade and over unity, whether individual EU countries particularly will rush to secure good bilateral relations with Washington and leave the EU less united, or actually Europe less united in favor of making good friends with Donald Trump. But the focus here will be very much on Ukraine, with President Zelensky feeling extremely exposed. Donald Trump has boasted he can end the war in Ukraine within 24 hours. What he's never made clear is whether he wants Ukraine to win. And the host of this meeting, of course, Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, a huge Trump fan who divides Europe and the West into pro-peace and pro-war camps. And he puts himself and Donald Trump into the pro-peace camp. He's repeatedly called on Europe to call an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine, and breaking ranks then, of course, you know, with other leaders here, including Keir Starmer, who say, you know, Ukraine should call the shots and decide its fate and when it's ready to sit down with Russia.
Europe editor Katia Adler in Budapest, thank you very much indeed.
And that brings us to 9 minutes to nine. A report published today by the judiciary says the current approach to adoption is outdated and can be altered without changing the law, which would mean that adopted children are more likely to have regular in-person meetings with their birth families in the future, rather than exchanges of annual letters. The steps have been welcomed as a seismic shift by family rights campaigners, likely to have a significant effect on adoption hearings throughout England and Wales. However, some are concerned that it may deter potential adopters at a time when numbers are already dropping, as Sancho Berg reports.
In a bright farmhouse kitchen, Tegan is mixing batter for her favourite sponge. This has been her home since she was adopted, aged four, but knowing her birth family has been important to her too.
I think it just gives you that more understanding view of all the elements of your life, you know, your birth family as well as your adoptive family, your foster family, whoever you've come from.
Tegan is 22 now. In the last few years, she's met her birth father, sister and grandparents.
You know, after my grandmother passed away, I went and saw my granddad and I was going to cook him tea, and it was a moment where his carer came in to check on him and she was like, oh, what do you want for dinner? And he was sort of like, oh, my granddaughter's cooking for me. And I could just see the pride on him.
Her grandfather died shortly afterwards.
And I think it's those little moments I wouldn't have ever got if it was just letterbox for their entire life and for my entire life.
Letterbox contact is the most common way for birth families to keep in touch with adopted children. Both they and the child send letters once or twice a year via an intermediary. That contact is ordered by a family court, part of the legal process. Face-to-face contact isn't supposed to happen until the child's at least 18, but increasingly that doesn't work. Younger children find their birth parents through social media and they reject the family who've brought them up. As one distraught adoptive father told us, his voice has been changed.
A year ago, I never would have dreamt this could happen. We had 14 really good years. She's always been such a lovely child, singing, dancing, very happy. She never seemed interested in her birth family, but we found out she'd been slipping out of the house at night for weeks to meet her birth father. Now she says she's going to live with him and his family.
A report published by the judiciary recommends a sea change in the approach to adoption. It says the current system is outdated and greater consideration should be given to direct, face-to-face contact. It's strongly supported by the most senior family judge, Sir Andrew McFarlane.
Bit by bit, there's been a growing understanding that the model that we've used for adoption with very little contact to the natural family is not serving the best interests of children as they grow up through the very difficult years of being an adolescent and on into adulthood.
He says judges can alter what they do without a change in the law.
It's designed to change the focus and encourage social workers and lawyers and judges to look more widely at the issue of contact.
Today, almost all adopted children have come from care, removed from their birth families because of abuse or neglect. For some, seeing their parents again can be deeply traumatic.
Hello. Oh, hi. Are you Cassie?
Cassie is 30 now, but she came to Dee and her husband John when she was only three. She didn't behave like an ordinary toddler. She would get up on her own, dress herself, brush her teeth without prompting, and she worried about the birth mother she'd left behind.
We'd go shopping and it would be, can you buy something for her because I'm sure she won't have this.
Social workers said that meant she should meet her birth mother. So Dee and Cassie saw her in a busy, noisy contact centre. It seemed to go well, but the day after Cassie was limp, tired, Dee took her to the doctor.
And we were in the reception of the surgery, and next thing I know, she's sick everywhere, and she's trembling. She was examined, and the very lovely GP said, organically, I think she's fine, but I think she's very, very traumatised.
Cassie only remembers she was terrified. She and her adoptive family spent years in therapy, then another more carefully arranged meeting, which went well. But Cassie has not seen her birth mother since.
I never felt like a strong urge. And I think also from the services that we received, I had knowledge on her. I had knowledge on my background, cultural background. I had that information. I think sometimes this emphasis on contact, we should have contact, really undermines the fact that these children have been taken away from these people because of serious, serious things that have been done or not done.
This is only a report, but it's likely to have a significant influence on family courts across England and Wales. Some worry this new approach may deter potential adopters at a time when fewer people are coming forward and there are record numbers of children in care.
Sandra Berg reporting. Well, it's just coming up to 9 o'clock. In fact, it's 4 minutes to nine. And at 9 o'clock on Radio 4, you can hear after the news In Our Time with Melvin Bragg. But after this programme, Justin and I, remarkably, given his working hours in recent days, are going to be joining Nick, who is in the Today podcast studio, for a live recording of the second edition of the podcast this week on BBC Sounds. And I think, Nick, I'm right in saying that you're ready and waiting upstairs and can explain to me and Justin what on earth we're doing.
Yes, I'm a floor up at Broadcasting House. Now, this concept of a live programme may not seem that new to you.
A live podcast, young man.
Didn't seem that new to Marconi, in truth. We've been doing it for decades. What is new about it isn't on the radio. It's streamed. It's on BBC Sound. So, in other words, if you want to hear more about the American election, if you want to ask us a question or hear our answers to other questions, Justin's going to join us, as you say, and you go to what's called the live news stream on BBC Sounds. Now, look, if you're used to it on your phone, on the app, it's got all the radio stations at the top, and you use your finger and you just scroll along. When you get past Radio 4, you get to the World Service, you'll see something that says BBC News. You can do it on a laptop or a PC as well. And if that's all too horribly complicated, don't worry. It'll be on the normal BBC Sounds stream, or you can even use a smart speaker and ask BBC Sounds to play live news. Now, you may prefer to actually send us a question and do that as well, in which case WhatsApp +44 330 123 4346 or email us today at bbc.co.uk and we'll do our best to be self-reflective about what we got right and what we got wrong.
Masterfully done, Nick. I shall see you upstairs in about 3 minutes' time. And Justin, amazingly, will be with us. Justin, we do feel honoured that you should continue. Well,
Nobody told me I was going to have to be self-reflective.
I'm going to invite you to be self-reflective because we're going to have lots of questions from listeners. But I just wonder, I mean, you're coming to the end of a marathon stint with editor out there, Dan McAdam, with Laura Hendry, our producer, and sound manager, Kate Barker. I just wonder if you've been reflecting a bit on, is it 23 years since you were first posted to Washington, and America is a profoundly changed country, isn't it? Economically, demographically, and politically.
Yeah, it's changed in some ways and not in others, though. I was here in the run-up to Barack Obama and the George W. Bush re-election, and there are some things there that are still things now. For instance, illegal immigration, what to do about the border, it hasn't been fixed. It's a running sore. It got much worse under the Biden administration, and it's a huge political deal. Demographically, the place has changed. Much more Latino voters now, and the expectation was always that they would go to the Democrats, and they haven't. And that's really the lesson of this election. So, yeah, all sorts of things bubbling under the surface, but the place itself